Let me ask you a question, Johnny Funkman. Did you personally face-to-face fire Vladimir Kozlov on Friday, huh? Did you fly yourself to Florida to tell Harry Smith, yes, his name is Harry, not David Hart Smith, that he was no longer needed here? Huh? Did you tell Chris Masters, somebody who over the past year has worked his ass off to get better, did you fire him face-to-face, or did you call him up and say, hey, kid, it's a budget thing. Best of luck in your future endeavors. Don't call me gutless. You have him do your dirty work.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Welcome to episode 700 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, April 18, 2021. We made it. We made it to 700. Take that, Pat Robertson. It only took 14 years to get here, but here we are. And I want to thank everybody listening for helping the show get to this point, because without you listening and tuning in and supporting every single week, we don't get to 700. So I have to thank everybody before I go any further here. For those of you wondering about the format of the show this week, it is no different than it is every week because there is a shit ton of news to get into. But that is why tonight I am going live on YouTube. We're doing two podcasts in one day. This, of course, is the regular show, chock full of news. But tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern on YouTube, I hope you'll join me for a live Sound Off inbox celebrating 700 episodes. It'll be like a little party. And I'm going to be answering your questions, your email questions. I have a whole bunch of them already teed up. Super chat questions and whatever other questions you throw my way. So that'll be tonight. That'll be the second show. But for this one, far too much stuff to get into, including, unfortunately, the WWE releases. They cut 10 people this week, including one name that just left me absolutely gobsmacked. I'm sure it was the same name that left a lot of you surprised. Also, what surprised me was the AEW rating. That was pretty shocking. We'll talk about that. Ton of announcer news to get into, including about the Impact pay-per-view. There is an Impact pay-per-view next weekend. Oh, by the way, Chris Jericho on the Broken Skull Sessions. Ryback makes an ass out of himself on Twitter. What else is new? And of course, the usual This Week in History segment, which has some fun things this week. So we're going to get into everything here. And I want to also let everybody know that if you would like to support and make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolemnmonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. We had a ton of them this week. I guess a lot of people wanted to get their name out there here on episode 700, so their names would be immortalized here on this milestone episode. And let me just say first, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, all I can say is thank you. He showed some heavy support this week, and I already thanked him personally, but Paul, I want to say thank you again here. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, there's a name I'm sure you've heard over the course of many of these 700 episodes over the years. West Coast James Herrera is another. Big Bear Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart. His niece is the adorable Abby Struble, and she turns 2 this Tuesday. Happy birthday to Abby. Hardy the Horse says hello. Keith the Conqueror Krajnik. Haven't heard from Keith in a while. Fast Blast Tim Banks. Velvet Revolver Robert Murray. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep. The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard. Ostentatious Alan Carter. The Firebomber Craig Foster. The Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, Sherrod, Big Daddy Boyd, the Angel of Anarchy, Lucas Kroll. Thank you, Lucas. It's very kind of you. And also we heard from the con man, Michael Connolly, who just received his Stone Cold Steve Austin legacy title that he won last Sunday from Wrestle Rumble. He says the belt is awesome, and that he is in awe just looking at it in person, which you should be, because from what I was told, in the case that it came in, the whole thing weighs over 40 pounds. So this is no, cheap little piece of crap. You got some quality craftsmanship over there, but very cool to hear that Michael got the belt, and I hope you enjoy it, brother. And also this week on World Wrestling Strea on YouTube, Adam breaks down the recent WWE releases and takes a deep dive into why AEW would be a great fit in his view for the Iconics. As always, there are daily reaction videos to things like the trailer for the new Zack Snyder movie starring Dave Bautista called Army of the Dead. I just saw that the other day. It looks very interesting. Although you could ask the question, after watching the trailer, in the middle of a zombie apocalypse, why are they so preoccupied with grabbing the money? I think it's, $200 million or something buried in a vault deep below Las Vegas? I don't know. Seems to me if there were a zombie, maybe it's just a zombie apocalypse in Las Vegas. Maybe that's the premise of the movie. But it does look interesting. He also has reaction video for the WWE 2K22 teaser from WrestleMania. You can find all of this and more at youtube.com/FWCIETC, or you can follow at FWCIE on Twitter. It's going to be more shouts coming up here in a little bit, so if you didn't hear your name mentioned, don't worry. We got more to come. I do want to mention for our YouTube channel members, for those who don't know, channel memberships are now open. They've been open for about 3 weeks or so now on the YouTube channel. You can join if you so choose, whichever tier you think works for you. The higher tier, the Legends tier, has and will continue in the weeks and months to come as I upload them, feature the lost episodes of The Sound Off. That being the episodes of The Sound Off that are really, you can't find them anywhere else. I just got episode 4. Fourth ever episode of The Sound Off from November of 2007. I just got that up this week. I'm working on the audio for episodes 5 and 6 to get that up. So just a little FYI for our channel members, part of our family on YouTube. And I got to thank you guys also for making last weekend so successful. We had over 160,000 views and counting on my WrestleMania reviews. So over 80,000 on both nights. We beat out some heavy hitters. So I got to say thank you. And it was very nice to see them back in front of a crowd again. And the next night, it was right back to the Thunderdome, which I gotta say, as much as it sucks to not be in front of live fans, now that they have moved the Thunderdome out of Tropicana Field into a smaller building, the old Sun Dome in Tampa, it's still not the same, but I like it. I just think the look of it in that smaller setting, I don't know if it's because it wraps around a little bit more than it did before. But I think the Thunderdome in a smaller building like that actually looks better. But like I said, it's still not the same. Justin Barrasso on the Sports Illustrated website had a note that WWE is working on a plan to hold SummerSlam in front of live fans this August. Now, I don't know if that means indoors. I don't know if that means outdoors. I think SummerSlam outdoors with a beach setting would work great. Preferably somewhere where it doesn't generally rain a lot after what happened last weekend. But SummerSlam in front of fans seems to be the goal. So that's pretty cool to hear. But the biggest takeaway from WrestleMania for me was the crowning of new women's champions on Raw and SmackDown in Rhea Ripley and Bianca Belair. Both ladies took that next big step in their careers. They got the stamp of approval. You know, Bianca and Sasha had, in my opinion, the best match on night one. It was only slightly behind that main event on night two. So both main events, I thought, you know, delivered what they were supposed to. And what's cool is that, you know, I've been a fan of both these ladies for a very long time. Going back to the first Mae Young Classic. And in fact, I want to play a little clip for you right now. I got to give a little hat tip to Jordan on Facebook for pointing it out to me. From Sound Off episode 512, right? Why not go back into the vault a little bit here on episode 700? It was episode 512, back on September 10th of 2017, 4 years ago. I ranked from third up to first The three women who impressed me the most and who I thought had the most potential to be the star of the women's division. So take a listen to this. Now, if I had to narrow it down to the three women who I think have the most potential to be a big deal, if not the star of the women's division in the future, I pick three names, okay, and I'm going to rank them from number three down to number one, or up, I should say, to number one. If I rank them in order, I would put Rhea Ripley at number three. I can't stress enough. I see big things from her in the future, and she looked really good in this tournament for somebody who doesn't have a whole lot of experience doing this. Number two would be Toni Storm. She's only 21, so only a year older than Rhea Ripley. She's got more charisma than a lot of the men do on the main roster. And number one would be Bianca Belair. She's a little bit older. She's about 28, I think. But she's going to be a very big deal. The standing vertical suplex that we saw from her in that match with Kairi Sane, the hair whip thing, the 450 she busted out in that match with Kairi, she showed a lot in that match. I gotta put her at number one. It's cool to listen to that and see where those two are now. And that was before Rhea got the complete makeover. She looks like a totally different person now compared to how she looked 4 years ago. But she's only gotten better since then. Toni Storm can still get there. She spent more time over in NXT UK than she probably should have, probably due to the pandemic. She only first really started up full time on the NXT brand a few months ago, but I think she'll get there. But Rhea and Bianca, they're already there. Exactly 1 year to the day of their Black Wednesday cuts, where WWE released dozens of talents and producers and other employees, it was time for more post-WrestleMania cuts on Black Thursday this week, as the company released a total of 10 talents for what many of them were told were for budgetary reasons. At a time when the company is making more money than ever before, they want to increase their profit margin even more. They also declared their quarterly dividend later that same day for shareholders, which was, I mean, it's a formality, but it was very unfortunate timing. It's the nice way of putting it. Topping the list of names let go, and the most shocking name of all, was Samoa Joe, who was last seen at WrestleMania last weekend dressed in a poncho calling matches out in the rain. Even though he hasn't wrestled a match in over a year, to say that this was unexpected would be the understatement of the century. The other names included Mickie James, Chelsea Green, Peyton Royce, Billy Kay, Mojo Rawley, Bo Dallas, Wesley Blake, Kalisto, and Tucker, formerly of Heavy Machinery. I'd like to drop some Heavy Machinery on the head of whoever thought it was necessary to break up Otis and Tucker. And judging from his tweets, it sounds like he feels the same way. According to Fightful, the newly reinstalled head of talent relations, John Laurinaitis, got to play Hatchet Man again and deliver the bad news to everybody. He was citing budget cuts as the reason. You know, that black goo that they use for Alexa Bliss, that don't come cheap. Neither do the magic CGI birds that fly out of Matt Riddle's flip-flops. Now, all of them have 90-day non-compete, so they will not be free to sign anywhere until July 15th, because they're going to get paid through July 14th, so I assume the 15th is the first official free day they would have. Fightful noted that several of the release names had inquired with management days or weeks earlier about whether or not they were on the chopping block. I guess they were worried. Maybe they knew, right? It's this time of year, spring cleaning cuts. They want to make sure their job is safe. Should I be concerned? And according to Fightful, many of them were told, no, you're not in jeopardy. Just, you know, don't worry about it. Only to get the call that they were released. And if that's true, of course, it is appalling. It's an appalling thing to lie to someone like that when they're worried about their job. But I don't get the sense they really care. You know, it's just, it's numbers. It's almost like the names don't even matter. You know, when you get into this big corporate setting like that, you're just a number. Now, I hate to see anyone lose their job unless they deserve it. If they deserve it, then fuck them. But I hate to see, you know, anyone lose their job. It's a shitty situation, especially now. I mean, even though it seems like we're in a, you know, we're in a better spot now than we were a year ago when the world was upside down and a lot of people were losing their jobs. It's just a shitty situation to be in. But the reality is, this is the company cutting what they feel is the dead weight from its roster to make their financials look sexier because they're getting ready to release their Q1 earnings this Thursday. And in many, not all, but many cases, these were people the company simply was not using. It was sitting around, they weren't doing much of anything. And you could argue that for a lot of these people, this will end up being a positive thing, because a lot of them are going to go work other places. Their career is not over, their life is not over. And hopefully, you know, the majority of them will end up better off, or they'll be happier, not sitting around in the back doing nothing. But you look up and down this list, and this was the list of names in many cases that were simply not being utilized by the company. So let's run through these names. Let's talk about them one by one. And we're going to start with the one. We're going to start with Samoa Joe. This is the most appalling of the bunch. Joe has not wrestled a match since February 10th of last year. It was an 8-man tag on Raw. It was Joe, Kevin Owens, and the Viking Raiders losing to Seth Rollins, Murphy, and AOP. Joe took the losing fall in that match. This was after Joe had been out for several months with a broken thumb. He came back, and he got concussed in a tag team title match on Raw. Middle of the match, in fact. They had to take him out of the match. He came back. He had a couple of matches on TV, and then he suffered another concussion during a commercial shoot, of all things. He was taking a power bomb through a table from the Authors of Pain, a spot that they kept in the commercial, by the way, which you can still find online. It was that whole Must Be Monday ad that they did for Raw at the time. And that concussion was said to be a very bad one. And also, it came so soon after the most recent one. So, back-to-back concussions. The second one was a nasty one. A few weeks later, he was suspended for 30 days for violating the company's wellness policy, and he has not wrestled since. They added him to the Raw announce team last year. He did well. He was pretty good at it. I know, shocking, Samoa Joe can talk. But, you know, cutting a promo and doing commentary are two totally different things. You never really know until you thrust someone into that role how well they're going to do. And, you know, he took what they gave them, or he took what he was given, and I thought he made the most of it. I thought he was pretty good in the role. Now, the belief is that he had recently indicated that he wanted to return to the ring. He was trying to make a comeback, and the company had not yet cleared him to do so. Now, unless we come to find out that he requested his release so that he can go work somewhere else, this makes no sense. And this is truly one of the dumber decisions that WWE has ever made. And that is knowing the man's injury history. I'm well aware of his injury history. He was definitely prone to injury, you know, later in his career. He's not getting any younger. He's got a lot of mileage on that body. But he can talk. There's an authenticity, there's an authority in his promos that, you know, when he is cleared, I'm sure at some point he will be, when he is cleared and when he is able to come back, you bring him back and you try again, because he can be a valuable asset to whichever roster that you want to use him on. In fact, I had just pitched only last week on one of my live streams, one of the 58 live streams I feel like I did last week leading up to WrestleMania. I had just pitched an entire comeback scenario for Samoa Joe chasing after one of the two top titles, either the WWE title or the Universal title, neither of which he has ever held before, which is just criminal to even think about. It's criminal that he never got a chance, even briefly, to hold one of those two titles. I pitched him as a potential opponent for Walter. That was another idea that I had. But he really should have beaten Brock Lesnar for the championship at Great Balls of Fire, that one pay-per-view match they had together. It was 6 minutes long. But for those 6 minutes, it was really good. You know, the promos were great. That promo he cut on Raw the next night after he lost, where Brock got all animated and got all up in his face, that's one of the best segments on Monday Night Raw in the last 5 years. And I know that's a low bar to set, But that was a fantastic promo. So, I mean, Roman Reigns was in the ring with them while that was going on, and he was just a background player. You could see him standing in the background. He was reacting like a fan. It was almost like, yeah, this is how you cut a promo. We had two Samoans in the ring named Joe, and one was cutting promos. The other one wishes at that time that he could cut promos the way that Samoa Joe was cutting a promo on Brock Lesnar. There was another segment on SmackDown where he was cutting promos on five different guys in the ring at once. That was the one where he made the double A crack about Jeff Hardy, the AA crack. I mean, if words were gold, this man would be a walking Fort Knox. And you can't find a way to use Samoa Joe? But then again, this is the same company that wouldn't even give this man the time of day for how many years? When he was in TNA? People forget about that. You know, Joe had a choice, and he chose to sign with TNA, and I'm sure he re-signed with them a few times. So, you know, he bears, you know, part of the blame for this as well. But don't forget that this is a company that for years, when Samoa Joe was in TNA or when Samoa Joe became available, they did not have any interest in even looking at him. They were not looking for guys who looked the way that Samoa Joe looked. And the real sin is that it took as long as it did for him to even get to WWE in the first place. By the time he got to WWE, what was it, 2015, I think, he was already past his physical prime. I mean, he could still go, but even the Samoa Joe in 2015 was not the same Samoa Joe from 2010, 2007, you know, Ring of Honor Joe, TNA Joe. He wasn't quite that guy anymore. But he was still Samoa Joe. You know, when he signed with NXT, it was a special deal. Even when they did sign him, it was a special contract where he could still work outside dates on independent shows. They had no intention of bringing this man up to the main roster. And do you remember what it was that got them to change their mind and do a 180 on Samoa Joe? His merch sold well. It might have just been one t-shirt. Whatever it was, they put it up on WWE Shop and it sold out. His shirt was selling like hotcakes, and that got their attention. So they never wanted him in the first place, but he could sell. He could sell merch, he could sell you with his promos. And if the injuries didn't pile up, who knows how differently things may have, you know, turned out. But even with all of the injuries, you don't cut someone like Samoa Joe. Now, where he goes from here, you know, he and CM Punk were tweeting at each other. And in fact, CM Punk was doing a Q&A on Twitter just the other day, and somebody asked him, you know, would you be interested, or do you see yourself one day working a match against Samoa Joe? And his response was, never say never. But the two of them were tweeting little vague comments at each other. And I was thinking about this, because everyone is immediately thinking of, oh, the big companies and where he could go. If those two guys ever got together and wanted to do an independent match and not rely on WWE or AEW or any other company, if they wanted to get together to do an independent match against each other, you build this big indie card around Joe versus Punk as the main event, it would do gigantic business as indie shows go. Post-pandemic, you find a building that fits 5,000 people, 10,000 people, very much like the All-In thing a few years ago. You build around that as the main event. They probably have to partner up with some, you know, different promotions. It would be very similar to an All-In type of thing, but with that as the main event. I have no doubt that it would do well. But, you know, the easy answer as far as where Samoa Joe ends up, the easy answer would be, oh, Tony Khan, he should be on the phone to Samoa Joe the second his non-compete is up. But AEW has more than enough talent at the moment. If I were to make an exception, and of all the names that were cut this week, who's the one man or woman that I would say AEW should grab in a hot second? It's Samoa Joe. You know, he could go back to Impact, he could go back to Ring of Honor. There might be some nostalgic value in doing that because he made his name in Ring of Honor and he had such a long run in Impact. That would be a gigantic step down. He needs a bigger audience than either of those two companies, even put together, can offer him. Now, I have no idea if he would be interested in traveling to Japan. I mean, obviously, there's any number of matches waiting for him over there. But if AEW is going to pick up just one person of these 10, there is no question about who it needs to be. The name is Samoa Joe. Mickey James was another name on that list. Mickey James, not surprising. It never felt like they really appreciated her being there. Never felt they cared to do anything with her more than they were doing, which wasn't much. I know she had tried out, I guess, on commentary. She had a tryout. I don't know if it just didn't fit what they were looking for. She'd be a great veteran presence on any roster. Maybe she links up with Nick Aldis on NWA Power or Power Surge, whatever they're calling it now. That's a possible, I think, destination for her. I don't know. That's assuming that she wants to go somewhere else and just resume her career full time. I think she could be an asset to any women's roster she ends up on. And then we have the Iconics, Peyton Royce and Billy Kay. What a great move that was, huh? Breaking up the Iconics. Made about as much sense as breaking up the Hurt Business. Or Heavy Machinery. Yeah, it's one thing to break up a team if you have better plans for them. Or you have bigger plans for one of them. When you don't have anything better for either of them, and you just break them up for the sake of breaking them up, you know what that means? You just have poor judgment. That's what that means. You know, Vince McMahon was once said to be very high on Peyton Royce. He was high on something, but it clearly wasn't Peyton Royce. Now, I don't know if she's going to join her husband in AEW or not. Impact has a pretty solid women's division of its own. Billy Kay was done the minute they broke up the Iconics because being in a tag team was really the best thing for her. That was the best possible thing for Billy Kay, was to be part of a group, to be part of a team. From an in-ring standpoint, she is not good. I'm sorry, she is just not very good. But it was still surprising because her act, you know, the goofy comedy that she was doing on SmackDown, it just seemed like the sort of thing WWE would love. You know, once they went all in on the comedy stuff with her. I mean, the comedy stuff got Santino Marella a job in that company for years. Same with R-Truth. But R-Truth is actually a really good wrestler. It's just that he's so damn entertaining, they've decided to have him do nothing but comedy. And, you know, R-Truth is probably pushing 50 years old at this point. He's probably perfectly content to do that. Now, I know Billy Kay is well-liked. A lot of people are very upset. A lot of people. More than I would think. Very upset that Billy Kay got cut. I think to some degree, she is a victim of these pandemic shows. Because in front of an audience, she might have gotten over, you know, pretty well. And maybe that... Now, I say maybe because, again, the comedy that she was doing on SmackDown, I didn't really find it funny. It wasn't appealing to me. Clearly, it was appealing to more people than I thought, just based on the reaction and the outcry on social media. Didn't do anything for me. So I don't know if in front of live crowds people would have really taken to it or if they would have been turned off by it. But it might have gotten over better in front of actual human beings. And maybe that would have saved her job. She did not have a good night at WrestleMania. Last weekend, that match was dreadful. That tag team turmoil match was terrible. And that is not all Billy Kay's fault, but she was part of that match. Coming off a performance like that probably did not do her any favors. I think the best thing for her would be to reunite with Peyton and do something together, either on the indies or for a company like Impact. You know, they can't call themselves the Iconics, but they could get some mileage out of a reunion, because for her, I think that's really the only option that really makes any sense. Chelsea Green surprised me because she was all healed up from her latest injury. She had just signed a new 3-year contract extension sometime in the last few months. Yet another example of WWE offering the illusion of job security. Just like that 5-year deal the Good Brothers signed before they were fired 7 months into the contract. Yeah, job security. But she could have been a real player on Raw or SmackDown, but the injuries just killed her. You know, she broke her right wrist in her debut match on NXT, and then she broke her left wrist in her debut match on SmackDown. So the injury bug just kept biting her at the worst possible times. She's the other name after Samoa Joe, I think, that AEW should look at if there was going to be a second name. I see her either landing there or probably back on Impact. The return of Laurel Van Ness. I know she just did, I think, an hour-long interview on Fightful with Sean Ross Sapp. I have not seen it yet, but apparently, they spoke for an hour, so I'm sure there'll be news trickling out of that interview as far as what her plans may or may not be. That would seem the most likely destination for her. Wherever she ends up, my suggestion would be wear extra layers of athletic tape on her wrists in her debut match, just to be safe. Mojo Rawley was also cut. Mojo Rawley was basically like a statue in the corner collecting dust. He was the victim of the dreaded start and stop push. I really think they only kept him around because he was friends with Rob Gronkowski. Once Gronk decided to go back to the NFL, because he was going to get a WWE contract, if you remember. This was, I think, last summer. He made the decision to go back to the NFL, which turned out to be a good decision on his part. But I think when he made that call not to stay with WWE, I think that Mojo had outgrown his usefulness to the company. You know, but the guy is a ball of charisma. He's definitely got an energetic, outgoing personality. It does work well on television, even though it can be obnoxious. I mean, you can utilize that as a babyface or a heel. So, I mean, he's got that going for him. In the ring, it's like I didn't see anything special, but he's got something that might make him desirable somewhere. Kalisto is talented. He is still part of one of the just most batshit crazy spots I've ever seen in a WWE ladder match. I think it was one of the Money in the Bank matches. He hit a Salida del Sol to one of the Usos off the top of a ladder, down through a ladder bridge down below. Still one of the fucking craziest things I've ever seen. He would fit in fine in any company. Bo Dallas, I'm surprised it took them this long to remember that he was even employed. He had not wrestled a match since late 2019. And he wasn't hurt. It wasn't like he was out with injuries. They just didn't have anything for him. I will always have a soft spot for delusional Bo Dallas as the NXT champion. And for him also mowing down El Torito on that one episode of Raw, when he used to do that celebratory, what would you even call it? Sprint around the ring, put his arms up in the air. And El Torito just so happened to be standing there with his back turned. And the camera was in perfect position, and Bo just mows him down. Oh, God. That was, again, one of the greatest moments on Raw in the last 5 years. Now, what that says about Raw is not good. But I will always have a soft spot in my heart for that. Of course they could have done more with him. You can say that about half the fucking roster. He's not the only one. There are people far more talented, frankly, than Bo Dallas, who they don't know what to do, anything. They don't know what they're doing. Apparently he's been working in real estate. He's been trying to get into a whole other venture. It seems like he already had one foot out the door anyway. I don't know that he's necessarily too broken up about this. I mean, I don't know him. I don't know. But it just seems like he was already looking at other fields outside of wrestling, outside of WWE. I'm not even sure he will sign somewhere else, or if he's just going to leave wrestling completely. That would be my question as far as Bo Dallas goes. Does he even want to wrestle? Or is he ready to just take up a whole other career? Wesley Blake was let go. Wesley Blake was let go, yet Jackson Ryker continues to pollute my television screen every single week. You know, when Steve Cutler got axed a couple of months ago over the COVID stuff, that was the end for Wesley Blake. It's very likely that Cutler would have also been on this list, probably, had he still been around. But, you know, he was a perennial tag team guy. They broke up Blake and Murphy. They were a team in NXT, remember, with Alexa Bliss? They broke up Blake and Murphy once Murphy got called up. Then he was thrust into the Forgotten Sons of Anarchy on NXT. And then the stuff happened with the Forgotten Sons, thanks to the heat on Riker. And then Cutler recently got fired. So I feel bad for the guy. You know, none of that was his fault. He didn't do anything wrong. But he got caught in the crossfire. And I know he and his wife are expecting their third child. So that's rough. You know, that's rough. And then there's Tucker. Talk about getting fucked over. Thy name is Tucker Knight. He and Otis got called up to a division that badly needed some new teams. It seemed like they were getting over slowly but surely. Otis was the wild and wacky one. You know, he's the one you figured Vince McMahon would either laugh at and like the most. Or maybe he just would completely hate him. I figured Vince would probably get a kick out of him. Just based on some of the people he's pushed before. But Tucker was impressive in his own right. Tucker didn't get enough credit, I think, for also being good. It wasn't like Otis was the only one worth anything on that team. You know, Tucker was doing pretty well for himself when they would, you know, be in matches together. And then they split them up for no reason. No good reason. And they had Tucker cost Otis his Money in the Bank contract. But because they drafted them to separate brands, they never even followed up on it and had a match. And then Tucker ended up on TV that one time in a singlet looking like one of those job guys straight out of a late 80s syndicated show. And you knew that was it for him. That was the death of Tucker. When he showed up on television looking like that, you knew the writing was on the wall in neon paint. You knew that this guy, his run was done. You done, son. You knew it at that point. Tucker's WWE career ended that day. This was just the paperwork to make it official. And again, you know, if you don't have anything better planned, then why split them up in the first place? They split up the Iconics and they put Peyton Royce in a makeshift team with Lacey Evans. She went from one partner to another. They had Billy Kay lobbying to join the Riot Squad. On SmackDown, trading one group for another. They took Otis and they put him with Chad Gable, trading one partner for another. Although it's great, because at least it gets Chad Gable some time on television. Gets him out of that horrendous Shorty G gimmick. So for Gable, it was a positive. But trading partners, I mean, it's a lateral move. It's not a sign of any kind of upward mobility or some kind of big plan the company has for you. So Otis went from one partner as a babyface to another partner as a heel. That's really all that happened. So someone on Twitter asked Tucker, hey, why did they ever break up Heavy Machinery? And his response? Who fucking knows? Then the person said, oh, it really pissed them off that they did that. And Tucker said, piss me off too, dude. And when someone else chimed in and said, we're just not allowed to have nice things or have fun, apparently, it's baffling. Tucker's reply, not with a certain old man in charge. All I can say is, I hope he has a chance to show what he can do somewhere. Do I see Tucker going on to become the next big thing in pro wrestling? No. Do I think he can go somewhere and be a perfectly serviceable part of the roster? Yes. And because I feel like this guy truly got royally screwed, I want to see him succeed somewhere. Whatever success looks like, however you measure success, maybe they put him with a new partner. But if anybody from this list deserves a chance to go somewhere and really show what they can do, this guy never even had a shot. So I hope he lands on his feet somewhere. No mention of Keith Lee, who is still out with whatever issue, medical issue, whatever it may be. Ricochet, no mention of Ricochet. Or anyone else that people have been clamoring to see leave and go somewhere else. Aleister Black was not among the names either, because Aleister Black is apparently on his way back. He has filmed new vignettes for his return that should begin airing on TV very soon. I saw he posted something already on his Instagram page. It's part of what he calls his Black Arts series of videos. the last of which he posted back in January. Now, mind you, he hasn't wrestled a match since losing to Kevin Owens on Raw back in October. Then he got drafted to SmackDown. He has not been seen since. But this latest video is titled Black Arts Part 8, Chapter 0, Forgive Me, Father. And in the video, he says, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 4 years since my last confession. 4 years of perpetuating this lie about who I am and who I am not. But I seem to have stumbled into your woods once again, and this time I will heed the call. It is time to cull the herd." And at that point, he puts on a pair of eyeglasses, and he turns and he faces the camera. It is shameful what has happened to this man's career since being called up. This is their chance for a reset. If they keep him on SmackDown, just keep him the hell away from Seth Rollins. That's the only thing I ask. After all the stuff we had last year, and the eye stuff, and the pirate eye patch, keep him away from Seth Rollins. We got some more 700 shouts here this week for our beloved members of the Sound Off family, including the Lake George Lunatic, Bobby Blanchard. Thank you for your support this week, as well as the Alabama Assassin, Chris Young, the Carolina Panther, Bradley Gooch, Jonathan Killjoy Keen, the Life Ruiner, John Schultz. It's a hell of a name. I can't take credit for it, but apparently he ruins lives. The Chicago Screamer, Ian Noel Camelotes, the Bakersfield Brawler, Kevin Velado. Thank you, Kevin. The best, the best, the best, Christian Ortiz, the Queen City Saint, Pablo Pablissimo, Chris Killswitch, Kukler, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, the 90s Vampire, Eddie Valens, Deadwood, Dylan Laporte, Ryan the Dagger McTaggart, Postmaster, Brian Blair, no, not that Brian Blair, Misfit Miguel Mendoza. Check out Miguel's Twitch channel at twitch.tv/elmocoloco. That's ELMOCHOLOCO. El Moco Loco, where he streams Call of Duty Warzone right now. And finally, Belt Fan Brent Banner, who says, "Break out the RVD rolling papers, available now on the How Did We Even Get Here podcast. Brent and Trey go on a Weedology tour to celebrate the most wonderful time of the year, 420. Follow the boys as they go to some of the hottest smoke spots in L.A., and roll up a fatty with these dad bod daddies," is what they say. Oh my God. Every Thursday, wherever you find your favorite podcast, just search How Did We Even Get Here, or go to YouTube at tinyurl.com/getheretube. The WWE bloodletting was not the only surprise this week. The ratings are in for NXT and AEW, and now that the Wednesday night skirmish is over, both shows came up aces. On its first unopposed night on Tuesday, NXT, coming off last week's takeover shows, did 805,000 overnight viewers on USA Network, which is way higher than what it typically does. I mean, it's done higher than that before, but on average, I mean, there have been some NXT shows that haven't been able to crack the 600K mark. So 805 is a very good number for NXT. It beat out the NBA on TNT by over 150,000 viewers. But it was the AEW rating that made my jaw drop. If I looked at the NXT rating, I said, hey, that's a good number. When I looked at the AEW rating, I thought I was looking at an incorrect number. I did not think they were cracking a million viewers this week. They didn't just crack a million viewers, they smashed it with a sledgehammer. Over 1.2 million viewers on TNT Wednesday night for a taped show that featured the second straight appearance by Iron Mike Tyson, who Tyson was live on the show the week before, and they didn't do those kinds of numbers. But then again, they were up against night one of TakeOver, so that's obviously a little unfair. But, you know, I didn't think that Mike Tyson on his own would account for hundreds of thousands of extra viewers, but he was back on the show this week. He served as the special enforcer for a Chris Jericho-Dax Harwood match that peaked Yes, a Dax Harwood match peaked with over 1.4 million viewers for the finish of their match. Now we know why Vince McMahon wanted to counter-program so badly against AEW. How long before they move NXT UK to Wednesdays on USA? They're probably putting the press release together as we speak. The show is up almost 80% from the week before. It ranked second on all of cable in the 18 to 49 demo. That 1.2 million number is the second highest in the history of the show, second only to the premiere 2 years ago. That is a phenomenal number. And it shows how much running on the same night was hurting both shows. They combined this week on separate nights for over 2 million viewers. When was the last time NXT and AEW combined in the same week for anywhere close to 2 million viewers? It is interesting that AEW gained a lot more than NXT did. So more NXT fans checked out Dynamite than the other way around. And one was live and one was taped, which just goes to show you that that doesn't always mean anything. But it also shows that it is a virtual lock. We will never again see anyone from AEW or even hear the initials AEW uttered on the WWE network. It is impossible to know exactly how much of that rise should be credited to Chris Jericho's appearance on the Broken Skull Sessions. You know, in a week where they were running unopposed, they were promoting Mike Tyson. So there were a few different reasons you could point to why the rating was so much higher. But I find it impossible to believe that it didn't help at least a little bit. I mean, look at the timing of it. It is not a coincidence that Chris Jericho was on the WWE Network or on Peacock, you know, whatever, talking in a complimentary way with Steve Austin about AEW, and a few days later they do their second biggest number of all time. That's not a coincidence. And I'm going to talk about the interview itself here in a little bit. But I am sure that Vince McMahon is regretting that decision to allow Chris Jericho on that show. The timing, though, I mean, could not have been any better for AEW. They dropped that interview WrestleMania weekend, only days before their first unopposed show on TNT. The timing could not have been better. Now the question turns to whether or not they can keep that audience. I expect a drop this week, but if they can stay over a million, if they drop, let's say, from 1.2 million to a million and change overnight viewers, because they always did a million when you factor in DVR numbers and stuff. NXT, I don't know if they did every week over a million when you factor that in, but they're also on the network, so how much of that audience, you know, they don't release those numbers. And I've said before, if the audience for NXT on the WWE network was so great, then WWE, they love numbers, right? They love putting out press releases and tweets about how great they are and how big their social media numbers are and their television ratings are when they have a big number. I cannot imagine that the numbers on the network are that great anymore for NXT, or else WWE would tell people. They'd be shouting it from the highest rooftop. But if AEW in that overnight non-DVR number can stay over a million, that would be a great sign. It means people liked enough of what they saw last week. What they saw was a good show with one of the best matches in the history of the company. They had Pac and Rey Fénix challenging the Young Bucks for the AEW Tag Team titles. It was a hot opener. I know they're very polarizing, are the Bucks. And really, everybody in that match, that whole style, just the constant spots and the high spots and the no-selling of certain moves. I'm not a fan of that. But I watched that whole match from start to finish, and I thought it was excellent. That's a hot way to start out your television show. They had a TNT title main event with Darby Allin, who apparently is a ratings draw for this company, beating Matt Hardy. As fun as I did think it was fun, even still, overbooked beyond belief with the interference was that main event. But I thought it was a fun match. You know, they had even the Jade Cargill match against Red Velvet was very good. Especially when you consider that that was only Jade Cargill's fourth pro wrestling match. But Tony Khan, he clearly saw that rating when it came out, and he wants to keep the momentum going. He wants to keep those extra viewers because AEW has since announced a new match scheduled for Dynamite this Wednesday, and it's a good one. Darby Allin will defend the TNT Championship against the unbeaten number 3 ranked wrestler in AEW in Jungle Boy. Two of the youngest, most popular stars they have on that entire roster going one-on-one for the TNT title. I cannot wait for that match. It is too soon, I think, for Jungle Boy to win it. Timing isn't right. I would go for the time limit draw here in this match. My only hope is that they keep the interference out of it. Please, keep the interference out of this match. But you couple that match with the matches they've already announced. Hikaru Shida is going to be defending her AEW women's title against Ty Conti. Christian Cage one-on-one against Powerhouse Hobbs. Ricky Starks one-on-one against Hangman Adam Page. All singles matches. Can you believe this? I couldn't believe it when I read this initial lineup on the stream on Wednesday. I was like, am I seeing things here? I said, is Tony Khan feeling okay? Is he running a fever? Not a multi-man match to be found. Now, I'm sure they're going to add one or two later on as the week goes on. But right now, it is all singles matches. Very unusual for an AEW show. But one final AEW note. I want to play another clip for you. This one is from Sound Off episode 670 in September of last year. How does she not understand that this could be her last chance? I mean, does she not recognize this? This could be this woman's last shot on a national stage, and she is going to fuck it all up. And then she'll have no one to blame but herself. She will not be able to blame AEW or WWE or anyone else. She will have nobody to blame but Ivelisse. Boy, I sound like Solo Damas with all of the clips this week. It only took 7 months, but it looks like Ivelisse may be done with AEW. She posted a tweet that she later deleted, saying, "History repeats itself, unfortunately. I speak up about mistreatment and get let go. That's life." AEW has been silent so far on her status, but there were reports of issues with agents backstage, which is why it's been weeks since she has appeared on any of their shows. She has been MIA. She is claiming mistreatment from certain agents there. Also, issues working with Thunder Rosa. Yeah, it's very interesting how we don't hear about anybody else having issues there working with Thunder Rosa. Only Ivelisse. And she was going off on Thunder Rosa in replies to people on Twitter about Thunder Rosa being unprofessional. I said it on Wednesday, because this news, if you call it that, broke on Wednesday, so I talked about it at the beginning of the Dynamite stream, and I said it then. They should have washed their hands of this woman after that embarrassing snapmare spot in her match with Rosa on Dynamite months ago. And for her to accuse Thunder Rosa of acting unprofessional when that clip exists is just high comedy. It is such great comedy that Vince McMahon wants to sign it to a contract. Nobody loves their comedy more than Vince McMahon. I don't know if she deleted the tweet because she's not officially gone yet, but if she is, and AEW has said nothing publicly about any of this, if there was mistreatment, then she hasn't spelled out what it was. She only put out that one vague tweet. If she is gone, then that's it. She blew the final chance that she will ever have with a major company. And I feel like an idiot for even advocating for her to be hired in the first place by WWE or AEW. You know, the fact that WWE didn't sign her when they stockpile everybody else like wood for a campfire, that should have been a giant neon sign. But it looks like this story has ended in predictable fashion. And of course, you know, she might talk about it as, you know, her being the victim and everything. And look, I said, if there's mistreatment of any kind, then she should come out and let people know what it was. I mean, I would hate to think that other people in the company might be mistreated by the same individual. What does that even mean? What does mistreatment mean? That can mean so many different things. That's the thing. She was so vague about it. And then she took the tweet down. So it just reads like, you know, woe is me, she's the victim again, and she has seemingly, possibly, burned another bridge. And she has nobody to blame, as I said in the clip, nobody to blame but Ivelisse. Lots of announcer news and announced team shakeups in the news this week. Tom Phillips is no longer the voice of Monday Night Raw. He has been banished to the purgatory of 205 Live. He would have a bigger audience listening to him if he was standing in the middle of the local farmer's market with a bullhorn than he will calling matches on 205 Live. I love the press release they put out. Tom Phillips is still with the company. He's being moved to 205 Live, and he's still in charge of this and that. It's like, really? I mean, you try to bullshit us into believing that this was some kind of a, almost like a promotion of sorts for Tom Phillips. Well, Tom is going to be doing this show now instead of that show. This was not a promotion. This was a demotion of the worst kind, no matter what you think of Monday Night Raw, to go from calling as the lead play-by-play announcer, calling the flagship show on USA Network 3 hours every Monday night, to being on 205 Live is like being put in solitary confinement. So, adios, Tom Phillips. It was nice knowing you. He has been replaced by Adnan Virk, formerly of ESPN, now working for MLB Network. The new team is Adnan Virk, Corey Graves, and Byron Saxton. I watched the show on Monday, which I'll talk about. I listened to Virk on his first night on the job. He sounds like he's out there calling a baseball game. That's what he sounds like. Which is not good for a pro wrestling show. But it's been 1 week. Maybe he'll grow into it. He's not going to last long anyway. Let's just be honest here. He's not going to last long. And it's not even his fault. None of these people do. None of these people do. He is their latest attempt to throw a fresh coat of paint on a broken down used car. And it's nice to get a fresh voice in there every now and then, especially if you feel like things really aren't working. The announcing is the least of their issues, by the way, with Monday Night Raw. And I'll actually stick up for Tom Phillips in a way here. I did not listen or watch Raw every week, listen to his commentary and think, wow, Tom Phillips, he's this fantastic announcer. At no point did I think that. But Tom Phillips was very perfectly serviceable at his job, right? He knew what he was talking about. He knew all the players. He had been there for a number of years. He had a good voice. He was perfectly fine. He was not great. He was not terrible. He was exactly what WWE looks for in an announcer. He did his job well. There was really nothing wrong with Tom Phillips. And the fact that they have brought in someone who, while they may have been a wrestling fan, they may have been a WWE fan, so maybe Adnan Virk was watching for many years, maybe he knew who some of the names were, but he clearly is not as familiar with the product as Tom Phillips would be. He does not seemingly have the voice that you would expect, the emotion or whatever you want to call it that you would find in a play-by-play announcer on Monday Night Raw. What they have done is they have taken someone who was perfectly fine in the role and replaced him with someone who clearly is not as good as him, who is not as good of a fit. And they have done it just seemingly for the sake of doing it. And I don't know if this is completely accurate or not, but from what I understand, you know, Nick Khan is the new president of WWE. He's making a lot of big moves in this company. I believe this was a Nick Khan move. Nick Khan, and again, I don't know if this is 100% true, but I had read that he at one time represented Adnan Virk or may have been his agent or something. If that's the case, then that, you know, explains a lot about how he got this job. But I just find it ridiculous that you would take somebody who was good at what they do, who has the product knowledge, and replace them with someone who clearly is inferior to that person. If you are going to take somebody and replace them at their job with somebody who is better than them, then that's fine. But if you are going to replace them with someone who clearly now has to learn on the job, oh, well, he'll get better at it, or what, then why did you even make the change in the first place? Do you honestly believe that of all the problems that plague Monday Night Raw, the fucking play-by-play announcer was the biggest problem that you had? So I will stick up in that way for Tom Phillips. Didn't deserve to be replaced by somebody who clearly is not as good in that position as he was. But again, I don't think this guy is going to last very long anyway, because they're all a bunch of interchangeable parts to this company. Unbelievably, by the way, he claims, Virk does, that he still has yet to meet Vince McMahon. He was hired and made the new voice of Monday Night Raw, their flagship show, and he has not even met the boss yet. Which, again, it just goes to the point I was making about how, I don't know if haphazard is the right word for this move. It's almost like, you know, yeah, okay, you recommend this guy? Sounds good. Put him on the show. Like, no real thought was given to why are you putting this guy in this particular spot? Why do you need him in that spot? What does he bring to the show in that spot that the guy who was there before didn't already bring? I'll say one thing. His ear canal will quickly become acquainted with Vince McMahon. If he hasn't met Vince McMahon yet, his ears, he'll be acquainted with him pretty fast. That much we all know. SmackDown got the better end of the announcer shakeup. Pat McAfee is the new color voice on SmackDown. He now joins Michael Cole, replacing Corey Graves, who has moved over to Monday Night Raw. I prefer the two-man booth anyway, but McAfee, he's just a natural. He's a natural at it. It's only been 1 week. So we will have to judge Virk, you know, a month, 6 weeks from now. Same with Pat McAfee, but in the first week, Virk didn't really impress. Pat McAfee, I thought it fit him like a glove. It fit him like he had been there already working in that spot for months. He did well. He's obviously a big fan. He's got the product knowledge. He's got the charisma, which I think you want in a, not even necessarily in a play-by-play guy, but more so in the color personality. He certainly has a lot of that. He's got personality. So I think SmackDown got the better end of that. But on the subject of announcers, next Sunday, Impact Wrestling is losing its world title. Kenny Omega is going to beat Rich Swann in a champion versus champion match, winner take all for the AEW and the Impact World titles at the Impact Rebellion pay-per-view. I will give praise to Impact for doing what they can possibly try to do to make this match feel as big as possible. They hosted a 40-minute press conference the other day with Omega, Swann, Don Callis, Scott D'Amore, Tony Khan, all were present at the dais. It ended with Omega slapping Swann across the face. There was a big pull-apart brawl. And they have announced that Mauro Ranallo will be calling the main event next Sunday. Now, right now, it is just a one-off to give the main event a big fight feel. I think it's a great get for them. It could potentially lead to more in the future. Look, it could potentially even lead to something with Mauro and AEW. Don't forget, AEW has a second show coming to TNT later on this year. I don't know if it's an hour or if it's 2 hours, but they have a second show that's coming, not to YouTube. It's coming to TNT. Impact, I think as far as promoting this match, Impact is making all the right moves. But there is a glaring problem. The 800-pound elephant in the room. Why this is not working as well as it could be. Why this doesn't feel as big as it should feel. For one, Kenny Omega is not losing to Rich Swann. They could always do some sort of fuck finish where both guys keep their belts. That would only piss off the audience, though. That would make the audience feel cheated. You can't do that. And Rich Swann is not beating Kenny Omega for the AEW title. So there is no real drama there. The outcome is pretty obvious. And part of the reason that it is not in doubt has to do with the biggest problem of all. The name Rich Swann has not been acknowledged a single time on AEW Dynamite. If all you did was watch TNT, you would never even know that the AEW Championship was being defended next weekend. Now, maybe that'll change this week. Maybe they'll throw out a quick mention of it or a quick Kenny Omega promo on TV this Wednesday. They should. But they should have already been doing that. They have not mentioned Rich Swann. They have not mentioned this match a single time on Dynamite. Let alone the fact that their own world title is in, I mean, potentially it is in jeopardy of being taken by someone who works for another company. AEW may lose its champion in a week. You would never know if all you did was watch TNT. I mean, it's as if Impact is fighting a battle that AEW never even bothered showing up to. They're going to win by default. And that really has hurt the build of this match. But the idea that Rich Swann would be the one to take the AEW title from Kenny Omega, that he would be the one to end the reign that Omega has been on, is completely laughable. Rich Swann is a perfectly fine professional wrestler, but he ain't beating Kenny Omega for that championship. And if you think so, then you must be on some of that funny stuff. You got to pass some of that stuff along to me. We can sit and we can share it. Because Kenny Omega ain't losing the AEW title. There was also a Jazz retirement ceremony on Impact this past week. Jazz had already been retired, but she had come back in November. She came back to Impact. And she was on the show this week to officially say goodbye. And in the middle of doing so, she ended up in an impromptu match, which is ridiculous. But she did end up saying goodbye finally at the end. And it was, it was a very heartfelt speech. I watched it. 23 years in the business is a long time. And she never had any major success in like a big company in WWE. I mean, I don't believe she ever was the women's champion in WWE. I could be wrong about that. Maybe she had a run, but if she did, then it was pretty forgettable. She was definitely on the roster. She was a player in the women's division for a while in the mid-2000s, early to mid-2000s. But she never, was really pushed as a top player, but she has over two decades of experience. She's worked with a whole host of different women's names, and it has been a very long, impressive career that has come to an end. And I thought Impact giving her that forum to make a very nice speech and say goodbye was a very classy thing for them to do. Chris Jericho appeared on the Broken Skull Sessions last Sunday with Stone Cold Steve Austin. Day two of WrestleMania is when the interview dropped. Probably the second most anticipated Broken Skull Sessions they've ever done. Second most for me. After the Undertaker sit down, that was number one, both of them. But here you had an AEW star being interviewed on the WWE Network. So it wasn't so much that it was Chris Jericho. If it was Chris Jericho, the WWE guy, it wouldn't have been that big of a deal. But the fact that they would allow an AEW top talent to come on their network and talk about it, talk about the company put over AEW. They were showing still images on the screen of Chris Jericho as the Painmaker in Japan, Chris Jericho holding the AEW championship belt. I mean, this is stuff that would have been just inconceivable to think of even just a few weeks ago. So the fact that this even happened is pretty shocking in and of itself. But they talked about, how the whole thing came together. They spent the first, I'd say, 15 minutes of the interview openly talking about how this came together and talking about All Elite Wrestling. So anybody who thought they were going to shy away from it, in the press release that they put out, Steve Austin made it very clear that nothing was off limits and they were going to talk about everything, and they did. And that's the thing about Austin that I appreciate. He doesn't toe the company line. They kind of leave him alone and let him do his own thing. He doesn't bullshit you. That's what makes these shows and his interviews so good. But they explained how the whole thing came together, which I already talked about last week. They had to clear it with Vince McMahon and Tony Khan. They both approved it. Vince McMahon gave it the thumbs up and said, "I think it would be great, pal." And so that's how the whole thing. And of course, now I'm sure he's having second thoughts about doing that, but at the time, he thought it would be a great idea. And for the fans, it was, because I thought this was an excellent interview. Jericho's a great storyteller. He tells some great funny stories, and it was just 2 hours plus that just breezed by. And you felt like you could sit there for another 2 hours and just listen to these two sharing stories and, war stories and shooting the shit. But Jericho talked, and I'm not going to go through everything they talked about. I'll give you the top line stuff here. But Jericho talked about, the origins of AEW. And the fact that, to make something like that work, there's certain elements that you need. You need the finances. So many promotions and would-be promotions have fallen apart because the finances weren't enough, or the financing didn't come together, or they didn't have TV. I mean, there's certain things that you need. In order for something big like this to work, you need a TV contract. He said you need the finances and you need a group of about half a dozen guys to build a company around. And he put over Tony Khan, obviously, for having the finances and for being a fan. But he mentioned that around that same time, you had Cody Rhodes and Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks, all of whom he named. their contracts were either expiring with their promotion or they were free agents. It all kind of came together at just the right moment. Jericho, you know, was part of that group. Hangman Page. It all just came together at the right time. And what was huge was getting that contract with TNT because, you know, at first they thought maybe it would be Showtime or HBO or Netflix. But really nothing can replicate a strong broadcast network, cable network. You're always going to get more eyeballs. Even as people flee cable and they go cut the cord and go to some of these streaming services, look, things might be different in 10 or 15 years. But right now, you're still potentially going to get a bigger audience, you know, with a well-promoted show on a cable channel like a USA or a TNT or a broadcast channel like NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, just because it's more easily accessible to a lot of people. And plus, you get the TV rights fees, right? So I mean, look at the money that AEW is getting on that contract. It's somewhere in the range of almost $45 million a year. Tony Khan has made it very clear before, especially through this pandemic, if they didn't have that TV money from TNT, there very likely would not be an AEW right now. Or certainly they would have had to cut a whole bunch of people the way WWE did, and they were able to avoid that. They didn't have this mass firing spree. They got rid of one person. Jimmy Havoc. That was it. That was the only person they really got rid of. Jericho talked about his New Japan match with Kenny Omega at Wrestle Kingdom and how Don Callis was the one who really brought them both together, two Winnipeg boys. Jericho's been friends with Callis, as Omega has been for many, many years. He talked about how it did great numbers for New Japan World and ticket sales spiked after it was announced. Tony Khan saw that. Tony Khan has said that if it weren't for the Jericho-Omega match in New Japan, again, there may not be an AEW. That was really the catalyst for getting things going with this new promotion. But he talked about what it was in WWE that really made him think, I'm done. I've got to get out of here. And that was being told that his match with Kevin Owens going into WrestleMania 33 would be for the Universal title. It was going to be the main event of the show. And then, of course, Owens lost the Universal title a month before to Bill Goldberg, and Jericho said, well, that's fine. But instead of being the main event, they got bumped to the second match on the card. And he said that was a slap in the face. That was something he just could not get over. Being promised the main event and then being bumped to the second match. He said it would have been better to put us in the opening match. If you can't be on last, you'd rather go first. And instead, they put them second on the card, which is kind of just a random spot. And he felt very disrespected by that. And that was where he said to himself, that's it. I'm done. He goes, I'm better than this. I'm better. If I stay here, then that's what I'm going to be going forward. I'm going to be a second match on the card guy. And I don't want to be a second match on the card guy. I feel like I can still be a main event guy. I still feel like I have enough value that I can be doing more than just being a second match guy. All the stories that he told are a lot of stories that we already knew about his debut and, the Malenko list of 1,004 hold segment, that classic segment on WCW Monday Nitro where they came back from break and he was still reading arm bar and arm drag from a list because Dean Malenko was the man of 1,000 holds. He said, well, I'm the man of 1,004. And he read them. So he talked about that. And he did mention, of course, the undisputed title win. Austin brought it up. Austin brought it up first. They talked about Vengeance in 2001 and the Festival of Friendship segment with Kevin Owens, which Vince McMahon had agreed to, all their big plans for it. And then Vince McMahon that week in Vegas, for whatever reason, was not there. He was not at the show. Triple H was running the show. And Jericho didn't name drop Triple H. He kept it very vague. He said it was one of the other people behind the scenes. But in other tellings of the story, he said it was Triple H. Triple H wanted to change all of these aspects of the segment. I mean, he wanted to change the entire thing. And Jericho said, no, we have this all mapped out. It's going to be this little swerve moment. And Vince already said it was fine. And Triple H was like, well, Vince is not here. And Jericho was basically like, well, fuck you. I'll call Vince right now. I'll text him right now, which he did. He said, are we still doing the segment the way you and I agreed to? And Vince said, yeah, gave the thumbs up. And so they did it the way that they originally planned. And he admitted when he came back, you know, through the curtain, whoever this person was, I presume Triple H, admitted, I was wrong, you were right. It was much better that way. So he shared a lot of stories like that. The biggest takeaway is that there is no bigger fan of Chris Jericho than Chris Jericho himself. He loves talking about himself. He loves talking about all of his great accomplishments. But you know what? He has led one of the most impressive careers in the history of the business. I agree with Steve Austin when Steve Austin says that Chris Jericho has had one of the greatest runs of all time. He came into this business at the tail end of that territory era. So he had a little bit of that when he first came in. He got to work all over the world. He worked in Japan. He got over in Japan. He worked in Mexico as Lionheart, right? He got over in Mexico. Obviously, he got over big here in the United States. He wasn't even positioned as a main event top guy in WCW. And I can remember this was during the Attitude Era. Even on the internet back then, and there was no social media, but everybody was buzzing about Chris Jericho and is he going to come to WWE? Oh God, if there's one guy Vince McMahon needs to sign and pick up, it's Chris Jericho. I can remember Vince McMahon was giving some kind of talk at Oxford over in the UK. And again, I'm just going off the top of my head, but I remember he gave some kind of talk or speech or lecture or something at Oxford. And I think they opened it up to questions, and obviously there were some wrestling fans there, and even there he was being asked, is Chris Jericho coming to WWE? And one of the newsletters, they reported on it, and Vince said, well, yeah, you never know, or maybe he said, we're working on it or something. I don't know what he said, but that's how big of a deal it was, and Jericho was positioned as like a middle-of-the-card guy. He was a cruiserweight guy for the most part in WCW. But there was this great buzz about him possibly coming to WWE and being this massive star, which he was not at first. But you know, although on his first night in, he's cutting promos on The Rock, and then he wasn't exactly positioned too high up on the card. But I think things turned out pretty well for him, and he did turn out to be one of the big stars in the entire company. You know, he won multiple championships. He worked pay-per-view main events. He got to headline a WrestleMania. He worked with all the big names of the modern era. Started his own rock band. He found success there. He got, you know, the Jericho Cruise, which has been a success. He did the match with Kenny Omega in New Japan, which is really what led to AEW and led to the run that he's been on so far. All the times he's reinvented himself. I mean, this man got the word it over. He got a scarf over. The click of a pen. A clipboard. He still has one of the top two debuts in the history of WWE. I put Kane number one, Jericho number two, probably Taz number three maybe, but Kane and Jericho to me are still the two best debuts for a star in WWE history. I mean, up and down the list, you gotta say, even if you don't like him, it is a really impressive run that he has been on. It is very impressive that he's been able to accomplish all of these different things. He says he gets very bored. He doesn't want to just be doing the same thing. So he's always trying to just branch into something new. And he's not shy about talking about it. But he's got a lot of interesting stories to tell. You know, the Jericho books, and I'll give a cheap plug here. You can find at least one of them. I think the second one on Audible. So when I've pushed the Audible link in the past, audibletrial.com/Solomonster, I've recommended that people, you know, pick up the Jericho book as one of their free books, because you get one free book. But I've read Jericho's books, maybe not the last one, but the first two or three that he did, and they were some of the better wrestling books that you'll read. You know, if I made a list of what I think the top wrestling books are that I've read, his books would be near the top of that list. So he has a way of telling stories. I thought this interview was very enjoyable. It was not an interview that I was ever expecting to see. And it's an interview that I don't think we will probably ever see again. I think this is the last time you're going to see something like this on the network. But if you're wondering if it's worth it to go back and check it out, then I would absolutely recommend it. The 2 hours just flew by. And this week's winner for Sad Tweet was a no-brainer. I mean, I created this for tweets like this. It goes to the big guy, Ryback. On Thursday, Ryback posted a poll on his page asking the following question. What promotion would you like to see me return to in 2021? Hashtag hungry, hashtag feed me more, hashtag Ryback. And the four options given were AEW, NXT, which is laughable, Impact, or retire. I'll give you one guess how this turned out. Nearly 29% said AEW, 14% said NXT, 7% said Impact, but the runaway winner by far, so far, poll still open, with nearly 50% of the vote is retire. Now, unless there is a promotion out there called Retire that I have never heard of before, it does not look like people are overly enthusiastic about another Ryback run. And even more awkward, he was yelling at people to stop voting for retire. He didn't take very kindly to the people who were voting for that as an option, which begs the question, if you didn't want people voting for it, then why the fuck would you include it as an option in the first place? He had to know that he was only inviting trouble by doing that. So, Ryback, your Sad Tweet winner for this week. Now, Monday Night Raw, this past week, what a boring, uneventful waste of a post-WrestleMania show that was. Oddly, we had a new United States champion crowned at WrestleMania in Sheamus, who was nowhere to be found on the show. We had new tag team champions crowned at WrestleMania, AJ Styles and Omos, who were also nowhere to be found on the show on Monday. But that would not have changed a thing, even if they were there. I already talked about the new announcer, Adnan Virk. He added nothing of substance whatsoever to the show. But what could he possibly add? You could have put Gorilla Monsoon and Vin Scully on this show, and they would not be able to save this shit. Matt Riddle has gone from someone I used to enjoy seeing to someone whose presence on my screen irritates me beyond belief. They fed him to Lashley, who beat him with the Hurt Lock, so at least Lashley racked up another win. That's the best thing I could say about this. He should have taken those birds and put them in the Hurt Lock, too. The Viking Raiders are back on TV. It's good to see Ivar is all recovered from his neck issues. He had been out for about 7 months. They beat the new jobber team. That's what they are. The new jobber team of Shelton Benjamin and Cedric Alexander. Charlotte Flair was back on TV. She was complaining about being left off the WrestleMania card through no fault of her own. Didn't explain why she was left off the WrestleMania card. She kept that very vague, saying that she doesn't take away opportunities from other women. She creates opportunities for other women. She goes, "I am the opportunity. I am the Eggman, I am the Walrus, cuckoo ca-choo." Wasn't even a bad promo. I mean, it was your standard Charlotte Flair promo. Wasn't necessarily bad, it was just more of the same shit that we hear from her all the time. But this led to a WrestleMania rematch between Rhea Ripley and Asuka for the Raw Women's title, and these two were just way off. I have seen Asuka have much better matches. I have seen Rhea Ripley have much better matches. Their WrestleMania match was marginally better than this, and even that was disappointing. I don't know what was going on here, but I didn't think either one of these two looked very good in this match. And to top it all off, they sent Charlotte down to interfere for the no contest and to lay both of them out. Now, Charlotte against Rhea, Or doing a triple threat, which it looks like they might be doing, that was the obvious direction for them to go. But I thought this sucked. Speaking of suck, we had a Nia Jax segment. She and Shayna Baszler were in the back. They were mocking Mandy Rose for slipping and falling on her ass on the wet ramp at WrestleMania. Mandy and Dana showed up. They took exception to this. This all led to a non-title match, although it was still a match against the Women's Tag Team Champions, that, in theory, if, let's say, Mandy and Dana were to have won, they could potentially earn themselves, right? A tag team title match next week, or at some point, maybe the next pay-per-view. So keep that in mind. They had this match, and it ended when Nia, trying to climb back up onto the apron to get back into the ring, she slipped, quote-unquote, and fell off the apron onto the floor, onto her hole. And then when an angry Nia stormed back into the ring, because she didn't like the fact that she had just been embarrassed, she stormed back into the ring to go after the babyfaces. The babyfaces, how did they react to this? They ran away and got themselves intentionally counted out. I shit you not, that was the finish of this match. Corey Graves sounded baffled by why they would get themselves counted out against the Women's Tag Team Champions. And then Byron fucking Saxton explained that Nia embarrassing herself and them running away, well, that was even better than Mandy and Dana beating the Women's Tag Team Champions. The fact that Nia fell on her ass was better than winning the match. Fuck this company. Fuck this show. And fuck me for continuing to watch this shit. Miz and Morrison, they had Maryse on Miz TV. Now, it's always nice to see Maryse. Or as Michael Cole used to call her, Maryse. Makes her sound like a 80-year-old grandfather going to a Jewish deli to buy some soup. We had Maryse on Miz TV. Damian Priest came out and he challenged the two of them before they could challenge him, because he was sure that's what they were going to do. He challenged them to a 2-on-1 handicap match, which he lost. So after putting him over at WrestleMania, they paired him off with Bad Bunny, this big celebrity. They got the win, even though Bad Bunny completely outshined him, because all anybody was talking about when it was over was Bad Bunny. Bad Bunny is now gone. Bad Bunny is getting ready to go on tour. Bad Bunny leaves, and the very first night after WrestleMania, they beat Damian Priest. Now, yes, it was 2-on-1. It was a handicap match. And yes, The Miz had his feet on the ropes. But you don't pin Damian Priest. And what did they do? They pinned Damian Priest. A joke. Pin Damian Priest. Miz and Morrison, they didn't even have time to change into their gear. Miz's pants got ripped off during the match. He acted all embarrassed when it was over that he only had his underwear on. Maryse was trying to cover him up. The man wrestles in his underwear every fucking week on television in front of 1.8 million people and shrinking. All of a sudden, he's embarrassed that people might see him in his underwear. Alexa Bliss. She was on her swing. She said that she did what she did at WrestleMania to Bray Wyatt because when The Fiend was gone and left her all alone, she realized she didn't need him anymore. She has her own powers. She is basically the female Fiend now, but far more attractive. I would happily date The Fiend now. The old Fiend, I would grab a beer with him, but I wouldn't buy him dinner or anything. She then introduced us to her new friend, Lily, which was a new puppet that was sitting on the swing right next to her. Now, later in the show, we got a Firefly Funhouse with Funhouse Bray. He was back. He says he feels reborn. And then he started talking like one of those con men preachers who heals everyone they touch. He turned into Benny Hinn. And he said that he will return. The Fiend is dead. Let him rest. This was always going to have a shelf life anyway. It's been a year and a half. I would like to sit here and say it's been a great run, but that would be a lie. That's not entirely true. Let him rest. Now, Alexa doing this is kind of interesting to me. I am kind of intrigued by where they go with Alexa as the Fiend. The Fiend himself? I don't give a shit. I actually care more about Alexa. Now, it's almost like, you know, Alexa, it's like giving a character from a television show its own spinoff, and you care more about the spinoff than you do about the original TV show, which rarely happens. Although I do have to give props to Better Call Saul, one of the few instances of a television spinoff that is every bit as good as the original. And I cannot wait for the final season, whenever that may be. But yes, leave the fiend be. He is done. Let him rest. And as far as Alexa and Lily are concerned, we'll see where that goes. And despite a clean loss at WrestleMania, Drew McIntyre is once again the number one contender for the WWE title. He will challenge Bobby Lashley at Backlash next month after winning a triple threat match over Randy Orton. And Braun Strowman, who is so proud of beating Shane McMahon at WrestleMania. The same Braun Strowman who, remember, sat in the locker room before WrestleMania when he could have beaten up Drew McIntyre and taken his spot, but he was more interested in beating up Shane McMahon because he can't do two things at once. Now he wants the WWE Championship. Well, he ain't getting it. Drew McIntyre is. And when the match was over, MVP walked out on stage and he distracted McIntyre as T-Bar and Mace attacked Drew from behind and laid him out. They were still wearing their Retribution gear, the masks. So they simply replaced Shelton Benjamin and Cedric Alexander with two taller people. That's really what they did. And if they're going to use them, then they should walk to the ring tomorrow night on Raw with Lashley and MVP, and they should pull their masks off in the middle of the ring and start over. Because Dijak and Dio Madden, they should at least get a fresh start. They at least deserve that much. T-Bar and Mace will go nowhere. The fact that there are still people who defend this show is, it's just baffling to me. But, you know, I've seen enough Law and Order to know that every scumbag is entitled to a defense lawyer. Raw is that scumbag. It's got a rap sheet a mile long. Where's Vic Mackey when you need him? Now, you've heard me talk before about shows and movies that show up on Netflix, then later you go to watch it and it's gone. Well, you can use ExpressVPN to unlock those movies and shows that are only available in other countries. With ExpressVPN, I've been able to watch The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air on Australian Netflix. So I get to see Will and Carlton and Uncle Phil again. And Hillary, of course. I had a big crush on Hillary when I was a kid. How did I do it? It's simple. ExpressVPN lets you change your online location so you control where you want websites to think that you're located. Here's how you do it. Just open the app, select a location, tap one button to connect, and refresh the page to access thousands of new shows and movies. That's how easy it is. You can choose from almost 100 different countries. If you're a Trekkie, you can watch Star Trek Discovery on UK Netflix. If you're a Rick and Morty fan, watch it on French Netflix. If you're an anime fan, watch as much of it as you want on Japanese Netflix. It works with any streaming service, not just Netflix. So try it with Hulu, YouTube, or BBC iPlayer. Of course, there are other VPNs, but I use ExpressVPN because I can stream in HD with no lag. And not only does it let me change my location, it also encrypts my data and lets me browse the web safely and anonymously. That's probably the number one reason why most people use a VPN in the first place. And it's compatible with all of your devices, phones, laptops, media consoles, and smart TVs. It works with all of them. Go to expressvpn.com/solomonster to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. SmackDown on Friday night. I talked earlier about Pat McAfee. Thought he did a good job on commentary in week one. As I was hoping, coming off his win at WrestleMania over Seth Rollins, they are going with Cesaro, seemingly going with Cesaro as the next challenger for Roman Reigns and the Universal title. Cesaro walked out to confront Roman after his gloating promo to open the show with Paul Heyman and Jey Uso. And Roman just walked out of the ring before Cesaro could even grab a microphone to speak. He is so beneath him, he would not even give this man the courtesy of waiting around to hear what he had to say. And they also replayed that UFO spot from WrestleMania, the no-hands airplane spin, I'd say at least half a dozen times. I mean, they were really putting it over like it was the most impressive thing they had ever seen. I mean, that's not even the most impressive thing I've seen Cesaro do. But my God, the number of replays, they really know how to take something cool and just drive it into the fucking ground. My God, with all the replays over and over and over again. I mean, if the goal is to turn people against Cesaro, keep doing that. Eventually, it'll just drive people so mad that they just don't want to see the guy anymore. Just show it, you know, three times. That's all you got to do. Come out of a couple of different commercial breaks. I could appreciate them really putting the move over, but let's not drive it into the ground. I mean, let's not beat a dead horse here. They did not announce that there would be a WrestleMania rematch on this show. They just threw it out there between Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn, with Owens winning again, this time with a lame count-out finish after Sami poked him in the eye and ran away. Owens brought him back into the ring, gave him a stunner when the match was over. At some point, they've got to start putting some heat on Sami Zayn. I don't know what their plans are for him going forward. I mean, I like him in the heel role. I wouldn't change him, you know, babyface just yet, but they got to have him start winning or doing something instead of just being a punching bag for everybody. Apollo Crews officially introduced the Yabba Dabba Doo guy as his new commander. Commander Aziz, a former member of the Nigerian elite army, who apparently moonlights or used to moonlight as a bouncer and a fighter. Not a bouncer, but a fighter in Raw Underground. I guess Omos, he was the bouncer. But they didn't tell us that Commander Aziz used to be an underground fighter on Monday nights. But they're putting over the taped up thumb spike. He's got his thumb taped up straight out of the Umaga moveset. The Street Profits were out with Montez Ford introducing his wife, Bianca Belair, as the new SmackDown Women's Champion, which I thought was a nice touch, having Montez be the one to do it. I said this last year, those two are going to be a money heel pairing one day. You know, I'm sorry to Dawkins, but Ford and Belair as the power heel couple, it's just too good to pass up. In due time. I'm telling you, in due time. Bianca thanked Sasha Banks for pushing her harder than she's ever been pushed before. Cesaro should be thanking Daniel Bryan for the same thing. She had also said that if Sasha ever forgets, she left a nice welt across her midsection from that braid whip for her to remember her by. They all embraced, and she told the Street Profits to go win the tag team titles in their matchup next against Dolph Ziggler and Bobby Roode. I like this. I thought this was a nice segment, a good promo by Bianca. Sasha was in the back after. She looked angry. She stormed off before Kayla Braxton could get a word out of her. So they're going to keep that feud going, as they should. Profits and Dirty Dogs had a fun match. I liked the blonde braid that Ziggler was wearing to mock Bianca. Ziggler and Roode retain. Natalya pinned Shayna Baszler as this feud continues, with Jackson Baszler against Natty and Tamina coming out of WrestleMania. I hate how many times I feel like I've seen Shayna Baszler rolled up and pinned on television in the last few months. I think it sucks, and it needs to stop. Especially when you have Nia Jax standing right there on the apron. Why does Shayna Baszler have to be the one to take all these pinfalls? Cesaro and Jey Uso, they were having a perfectly fine little match when he went for the swing and Seth Rollins interfered for the disqualification. So that feud must continue. As long as we get Roman Reigns and Cesaro, then it's fine. The Backlash pay-per-view is on May 16th. We have about a month. Maybe one more win for Cesaro on TV this time over Rollins to build him up even more before he ultimately, as we all know he will, falls to Roman Reigns. I don't want any goofy triple threat nonsense. Plus, you know, Rollins against Reigns, that's something you do when Seth eventually turns back babyface. Maybe in a year, 9 months. It should be Roman and Cesaro. You can get at least one pay-per-view match out of that. Do not deviate from that plan. Meanwhile, Jey Uso, this fucking guy, he gets involved in every Roman Reigns match. I cannot wait, by the way, for him to finally be barred from ringside for the Cesaro match. Let's say if they do that at Backlash, he gets barred from the ring, maybe even that night. He's interfering so much, he gets ejected or whatever. Only for Jimmy Uso to return and help Roman Reigns win. And then they play it up like, well, Jay was banned, what's he doing back getting involved in this match? And then they realize, oh, that's not Jimmy. Or that's not Jay. See, now I'm getting them confused. That's not Jay, that's Jimmy. So I was thinking, where's Jimmy been? Jimmy's got to be coming back any day now. I'm sure that he'll be linked up with his brother, because splitting up the Usos makes about as much sense as splitting up any of the other fucking teams that they've split up. So it's just a matter of time. But as post-WrestleMania shows go, much like Raw, I mean, this one was largely a snoozer. I mean, it was better than Raw a little bit, but that's not saying much. It's an hour shorter. There were a couple things on here I liked. But it was largely a snoozer. I mean, nothing important happened. There were no post-WrestleMania debuts, no Daniel Bryan, no Edge, no Big E. A lot of people missing. If you missed this show, you didn't miss much. Now, over on NXT, back on Tuesday, it was NXT's first night unopposed on Tuesdays, and Karrion Kross's first night on the show as the new NXT champion. And I liked his opening promo. I thought he showed great intensity. He was throwing down the gauntlet to anybody in the back to step up. And then nobody did, which was weird. But he came across very much like a babyface, giving Finn Balor his props as one of the greatest of all time. I am hoping Balor is next in line for Walter and the United Kingdom title. It was almost a year ago to the day that they were supposed to do a takeover show in Dublin, April 26th of last year, before COVID screwed everything up. That event has been rescheduled for June 21st, and it is still on the calendar for the, I think it's the Three Arena, is the name of the arena over there in Dublin. I don't know if they're keeping that date. I don't know if they plan to postpone it again, but if you can do it, you've got to do Walter against Balor. I mean, you got to do that match. What is the COVID situation in Ireland anyway? Some places it's spiking again, other places it almost sounds like it's non-existent. So for any of our Irish listeners out there, what is the COVID situation right now over there? Is it likely that this is going to be pushed back again, or are things opening up to the point where they might actually have that show in June? MSK retained their NXT tag team titles over Drake Maverick and Killian Dane, who earned a title match with a win over Fandango on the TakeOver Night 2 pre-show. Dane was ambushed by Imperium after the match, minus Walter, who was not there. I thought it was fine as a first defense for the new champion. A little weird, you know, baby faces against baby faces. But a fine first win for MSK. Mercedes Martinez picked up a win over Jessie Kamea and later confronted Zoe Stark in the back to set up a future match between those two. So it looks like Mercedes may be settling into the role of veteran who works with the new girls. Although she did throw out a threat to Raquel Gonzalez, the new champion. I wouldn't change the title, obviously, but a match with Mercedes would give her another credible name to beat after her wins over Rhea Ripley and Io Shirai. You know, Mercedes Martinez would be another big name for her to add to her list of victims as her reign is only just beginning. Speaking of reigns that are only just beginning, Kushida is the new Cruiserweight champion with a win over Santos Escobar days after Escobar unified the two belts with his win to take over against Jordan Devlin in the ladder match. This I did not expect, but it makes me happy because I was hoping that Escobar would actually drop the belt last week. And when he didn't, I was worried that he would continue to be trapped in that division. Now that he's free of the title, I mean, he may get a rematch. They may run that match back one more time. But if they keep the title off of him, it frees him up to move on to other opponents as a heavyweight. The match itself, I thought, was very good. It felt like more happened on the post-WrestleMania NXT than on Raw or SmackDown. And this title change was one of the reasons why. Dakota Kai introduce her friend, the new NXT Women's Champion, Raquel Gonzalez, who thanked Kai for helping her along the way. It's definitely a match in the making, by the way. I mean, come on. Seems pretty obvious to me. Just a matter of when. When do you do that? When do you go ahead and pull the trigger on that match between Kai and Gonzalez? Not yet. But the lights go out, and out comes Frankie Monet. So again, I said before, it feels like there was more that happened on the post-WrestleMania NXT than either Raw or SmackDown combined, and that's because there was. You had a title change, you had a new debut. So out comes Taya Valkyrie, that's her new name, Frankie Monet. She's got her little Pomeranian dog with her. She congratulated Raquel on becoming the champion, and she said that the best women's division on the planet just got better, just got shinier. She said, now that Gonzalez is at the top of the division, you'll be seeing more of me. And Raquel said that Monet is lucky that she's in a good mood tonight. But if Monet crosses her, she's going to shove that dog up her culo. Which means ass. See, I knew that. Been doing my Rosetta Stone. At least she didn't say up her papaya. But then out comes Rhea Ripley in a surprise appearance, the new Raw Women's Champion, former NXT Champion, followed by Bianca Belair. So they had both of the Women's Champions from Raw and SmackDown appear on NXT, where they cut their teeth and made a name for themselves. And they all stood in the ring together with Raquel. They all held up their belts. They were all smiling. They were hugging. They showed a photo on the screen of the three of them back in their NXT days. And look how far they've come. I like this segment. I thought this was very cool. Because you do, in these three women, you have three women who are going to be dominating in this company for years to come. Raquel is going to be next on that list. Rhea's already there. Bianca's already there. And it's very cool. You know, to see that they're having the success that they're having, because they're very good. I like all three of them. William Regal was hyping the signing of another new female wrestler who may be joining them one day. Signing of Japanese wrestler Sarray, who he calls the Warrior of the Sun. She makes her debut on NXT this Tuesday. Roderick Strong, with his wife Marina Shafir at his side, handed his walking papers in another segment to William Regal and says that he's done. He is done with NXT. He is quitting. And Regal says, I've had my issues with you and the members of UE in the past, but you handle your business like a man. I appreciate that. And you are welcome back to NXT anytime. And there are people asking the question, oh, this felt real. Maybe he's really leaving. They would not be doing this segment in the way that they did here unless he is either coming back to NXT at some point, or more likely, he may be headed up or down to the main roster. And if he is going to be heading to the main roster, I just can't see him doing well. And it's not because he doesn't have talent, right? He's a great wrestler. But I don't see him as being the kind of performer who is going to really thrive and do well on the WWE main roster. He's going to be one of these guys they look at as he's boring. And you know what? The thing about Roderick Strong, him joining the Undisputed Era was the best thing that ever happened to his career. Because on his own, he is very vanilla. He is very bland. He is very boring. He's not a great promo. His strength is in the ring. His strength is that he is a great wrestler. His shit looks snug. His shit looks good. It looks brutal. So he can work. I mean, nobody is questioning his ability in the ring. But everything else that people say about him and lack of a personality and stuff, it doesn't come across that way on TV. It's absolutely true. And somebody like that is not going to do well on the main roster. Or they're going to give him some kind of gimmick. He'll be a fucking accountant or something. It's going to be something horrible. So I would love for them to prove me wrong. I don't have a lot of high hopes if he moves to Raw or SmackDown. That's not me being Debbie Downer. That's me telling it like it is. Because you know I'm right. You know everything I'm saying right now is 100% fact. Now maybe they'll surprise us and he'll have certain advocates behind the scenes that'll go to bat for him, Triple H or somebody. It's possible, but I don't have a lot of high hopes. If he goes to the main roster, I hope he goes to SmackDown. Because on SmackDown, they have Daniel Bryan. who advocates probably for a lot of different people, as he has been doing with Cesaro. And look at where Cesaro is right now. He's at least getting a shot. I think if he goes to SmackDown, he'll have a much better shot at them doing something with him because Daniel Bryan is there. Hey, maybe Daniel Bryan can work on television with him. That probably would be his best shot. And I thought the mixed tag team main event was fun with Ember Moon, Shotzi Blackheart, Dexter Lumis, and Bronson Reed beating Johnny Gargano, Austin Theory, Candice LeRae, and Indy Hartwell. Reed pinned Theory to win the match. We had some intergender stuff in here. It was very limited. Indy Hartwell, her whole thing is she is smitten with Dexter Lumis. She has a thing for Dexter. And she collapsed on the mat pretending that she had been hurt or had taken a bump. And Lumis turns around and sees her laying there like the damsel in distress. And he goes and he picks her up and he carries her to the back. And as she's being carried away, she opens her eyes and looks in the camera and smiles and winks. She's got the hots for Dexter Lumis. Hey, some women are weird like that. What can I say? I thought this was fun. I didn't mind the angle. I thought I got a kick out of it, and I thought the match itself was fun. Nice to see Bronson Reed still being put over. You know, when he comes off the top with all that girth, I mean, he comes down with all of that weight. It looks devastating. The big splash, the tsunami off the top. I thought it was good.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, as we celebrate 700 episodes of The Sound Off, we go all the way back, 31 years ago this week on April 13th, 1990. It was the one and only time that WWE, New Japan, and All Japan Pro Wrestling ever worked together to produce the Wrestling Summit from the Tokyo Dome before a crowd of nearly 54,000 fans. Jushin Liger wrestled on the show, which is where that photo comes from of Vince McMahon sending Liger out to the ring for his match, like he's unleashing him. Kenta Kobashi tagged with Masa Fuchi against Tito Santana and Jimmy Snuka. Bret Hart and Tiger Mask 2 wrestled to a 20-minute draw. Tiger Mask 2 was a young Mitsuharu Misawa. And you would think, my God, a Bret Hart-Misawa match? That sounds amazing. Except it really wasn't. It actually kind of sucked. I believe Misawa had just come off a layoff with a knee injury, but they just didn't seem to gel well at all. A very disappointing match that, had it happened 5 years later, I suspect might have turned out quite a bit differently. Genichiro Tenryu beat Macho Man Randy Savage. Ultimate Warrior beat Ted DiBiase to retain the WWF title. Andre the Giant tagged with Giant Baba to beat Demolition. And in the main event, Hulk Hogan, who worked very differently in Japan than he did in the United States, beat Stan Hansen with his Axe Bomber finish. It was originally booked as Hogan one-on-one with Terry Gordy, but Gordy backed out of the match and Hansen stepped in. I don't know if Gordy got cold feet on doing the job to Hogan or what, but I don't believe such a match ever ended up happening between Hogan and Gordy. New Japan and All Japan, they didn't play nice for much longer after this, and it was a good decade before they worked together again. 27 years ago this week, on April 13th, 1994, after more than 2 weeks of deliberations, former WWE announcer and then WCW announcer Jesse the Body Ventura won a judgment in the amount of $810,000 against Titan Sports by a jury in St. Paul, Minnesota. He had been asking for more than $2 million. Ventura had alleged in his suit, which was filed back in 1991, that he was never compensated for his commentary that was featured on about 90 Coliseum home videotapes that WWE produced. And in discovery, it had come out that the company had been paying royalties to Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, Mr. T, Cyndi Lauper, and others for such tapes. Part of the judgment also included more than $8,000 for a calendar poster of him and a computer game with his likeness on it, neither of which he had received payment for. WWE filed an appeal the following year, but the verdict was upheld, at which point the company began muting his commentary on future videos and DVDs so they wouldn't have to pay him. Eventually, they stopped doing that, but it was a landmark case in many ways because it paved the way for WWE to more clearly define who gets paid royalties and for what, whenever their likeness is used. Now, of course, with the advent of the WWE Network, talent doesn't get any royalties for use of their likeness. And in 2016, Buff Bagwell filed a class action suit against the company over network royalties. Raven joined in the suit. And the following year, it was dismissed with prejudice by the court, meaning they cannot bring those same claims back before the court. 3 days later, New Japan Pro Wrestling hosted the inaugural Super J Cup tournament featuring the best junior heavyweights from all over the world. It was the brainchild of Jushin Thunder Liger. In the quarterfinals, Chris Benoit, under a mask as Wild Pegasus, beat Eddie Guerrero, under a mask as Black Tiger, to advance ultimately to the finals, where he defeated the great Sasuke to become the very first J-Cup winner. 25 years ago this week, on April 15th, 1996, Brian Pillman was thrown 40 feet out of the Humvee he was driving near his home in Cincinnati when it struck a tree stump. And per the April 29th issue of the Wrestling Observer, he was hospitalized in the burn unit in intensive care with severe injuries, including an ankle that was completely crushed. When police and medics found him, they saw that he had lost so much blood, they weren't sure he would even survive. And he underwent surgery to remove bone from his hip to help reconstruct his ankle, plastic surgery on his face to repair bone fractures in his face, which included a broken nose, a fractured cheekbone, and a dislocated jaw that had to be wired shut. He was not wearing his seatbelt at the time, but he was told that if he had been, and he was not thrown from the vehicle, it's very likely he would have been crushed inside and he wouldn't have survived. Not very often that you hear that by not wearing your seatbelt, it may have saved your life, but it does happen sometimes. I would not advocate not wearing your seatbelt. 2 days after his accident, Pillman's WCW contract legitimately expired, and he was negotiating with both WWE and WCW, but Eric Bischoff had a very real termination letter faxed to Pillman after the angle with Kevin Sullivan, the whole I respect you Booker man thing. They were working everybody, even the boys in the back. And to make it real, they had a real letter of termination drawn up, which was not very bright. Bischoff had every expectation that Pillman would be coming back, though, and signing a new deal. But on June 7th, he signed a 3-year deal with WWE in what I believe was the very first fully guaranteed contract ever offered by the company. Which was good for Pillman because he was never the same after that wreck. He was never the same in-ring performer when that wreck happened. He had his ankle fused into one position. He couldn't do any of the high-flying stuff he used to do. I mean, they used to call him Flying Brian. And this injury grounded him. He was in constant pain. Had he re-signed with WCW, what Eric Bischoff wanted was, he wanted certain provisions in the contract that would basically protect the company. So I think, if I remember the story correctly, every 90 days, the company would have the power to release him for whatever reason, and it's very possible that once they realized he wasn't the same performer, they may have ended up getting rid of him. You know, for the amount of money they would have been paying him, it's very possible that Brian Pillman would have at some point been released from his WCW contract once they realized that he wasn't the same performer he was before. That was actually the deal breaker that led to him signing with Vince McMahon, were those extra provisions inserted into the proposed contract by Eric Bischoff. The WWF deal, that was the safer way for him to go. 24 years ago this week, on April 13th, 1997, ECW held one of the most important events in the history of the promotion. Its first ever pay-per-view, barely legal, from the ECW Arena in Philadelphia, highlighted by Terry Funk, a few months shy of his 53rd birthday, winning a three-way dance over the Sandman and Stevie Richards to earn an immediate title match against Raven, which he won to become ECW World Champion. Paul Heyman's vision for this first pay-per-view was focused around Terry Funk, going for a major heavyweight title one last time, 20 years after losing the NWA title to Harley Race. That was the idea. But the show almost didn't happen. Viewer's Choice, one of the biggest pay-per-view providers, decided against airing the show months earlier. They took issue with the extreme nature of their content. Michael Klein, the vice president of programming for Viewer's Choice, told the Pro Wrestling Torch, "In looking at the demo tape they sent us, there was a scene of a kid receiving gifts from his father and the boyfriend snatching them away from him. This young boy was also shown in the wrestling ring about to be hit with a weapon by a grown man. We are not into censoring, but there is a guideline for what we will put on our channels. Portrayals of kids about to be beaten are not the kind of images we want to be in partnership with. So we passed on the show." Wade Keller of The Torch reached out to Request TV. He reached out to the president of Request TV, Hugh Panero, to ask about their status. And Panero said there were still some issues to work out. When Keller asked if the recent mass transit incident in Revere, Massachusetts had anything to do with the delay in making their decision, Panero was not aware of the mass transit incident, and he said that he was going to look into it the next day. When he did, Request decided against airing the pay-per-view. So Keller unknowingly tipped them off about the incident, which ECW had not informed them about, and that got Request to basically put the kibosh on airing the show. So once they heard that from Keller, Request went to Heyman and they inquired about this incident, and ECW had to come clean and tell them exactly what happened. Now, Request did eventually agree to air the show, but under certain conditions. For one, the start time would have to be pushed back to 9 p.m. They would receive a script of the show in advance that they could review, and there would be no excessive bleeding. This is the show where the famous speech comes from by Paul Heyman to the locker room before the event, which was aired as part of the Beyond the Mat documentary. Heyman gathers the roster together. He's standing on that staircase and he tells the roster, "There are 17 million homes that have availability for this show tonight that will pay $20, hopefully," and then he knocks on wood, "for the privilege to see you guys do what you have done for 3.5 years. Thank Terry Funk for all that he has done for this company, for helping to put us on the map, for being unselfish in selfish times, for taking the young guys and showing them a better way. Tonight, we have a chance to say, yeah, you're right. We're too extreme. We're too wild. We're too out of control. We're too full of our own shit. Or we have a chance to say, hey, fuck you, you're wrong. Fuck you, we're right. Because you have all made it to the dance. Because believe me, this is the dance." Less than 30 seconds after the pay-per-view went off the air, the power for the show, the generator, blew. Had that happened a couple of minutes earlier, it would have killed the feed right at the big climax of the main event. The very next day, on April 14th, 1997, WWE produced one of the worst episodes of Monday Night Raw in the history of the show, although some of the more recent episodes are giving it some stiff competition. This was the dreaded simulcast. Oh, I hated this show. Oh, did I hate this show? I remember watching this show live. I hated this show. This was the dreaded simulcast, with some matches taped here in the States, in Muncie, Indiana, and other matches taped from Johannesburg, South Africa, where they had been on tour. They taped content down there to air on Monday Night Raw. Vince McMahon and Jim Cornette handled commentary from the U.S. Jim Ross and the Honky Tonk Man were from South Africa, or at least they commentated on the stuff from there. I don't recall if they were actually physically there on the tour or not. Probably not. And they would cut back and forth between locations. I have no idea why they thought this would be a good idea. I vividly remember the production quality of the stuff from South Africa was just putrid. And the entire show was just one giant bore. But it is a significant show because it was the last Raw before Vince Russo was tapped to be the new head writer for the WWF. Russo was writing for the magazine at the time, and he had a meeting in Linda McMahon's office with her and Vince. This was weeks before, where he expressed how much more he felt he could be doing for the company. And in his book, Russo says he told them, "If all you think I'm capable of is writing the magazine, I need you to tell me that." And when they didn't respond, he continued on and he spilled his guts to them. And Vince McMahon responded by telling him that he was being very selfish, which Russo didn't understand. He thought he was being the exact opposite of selfish. He was trying to explain that for no extra charge, "I just want to do more. I want to do more to help." But it wasn't until after this Raw show, which was so horrible that it infuriated Vince McMahon, that Russo was called to his office the next day. And he thought he was about to be fired. So he gets up there and Vince's assistant, Beth, I think her name was, says, "They're in there." And he's thinking, "They? What did he do? Did he bring HR into the room to physically escort me out of the building? It's not enough to just fire me one-on-one. He has other people in there who are going to carry me out of here." When he walks into the conference room, he finds Vince McMahon and all of his minions, Jim Ross, Bruce Pritchard, Jim Cornette, Shane McMahon, Kevin Dunn. And at the head of the table, there is Vince McMahon, standing there angry with a copy of Raw magazine in his hand. And he slams the magazine down on the table and he says, "This is what Raw needs to be like." He says, "That show was a joke. Last night, it needs to be more like this magazine." And Russo says he can remember looking at Ross and Pritchard and Cornette and seeing the hatred and the contempt in their eyes. Well, I mean, with Cornette, it's not hard to believe. He was probably plotting the man's death at that very moment. But Vince McMahon recognized that a change was needed, and he did something about it. Now, whether or not you think it was the right move for him to make is up for debate. Obviously, it certainly paid off in terms of the way they changed their product, but he recognized that what we're doing right now is not working. That show sucked. That was embarrassing. And we have to make a change. If only the Vince McMahon of 1997 could speak to the Vince McMahon of 2021. If he was willing to take a chance and shake things up now the way he did back then. 21 years ago this week, on April 13th, 2000, one of the most bizarre matches in history, where a WWE contracted wrestler beat a WCW contracted wrestler to win the ECW world title on an ECW show. The story is that Mike Awesome, then the ECW world champion, was not getting paid, as I'm sure a lot of guys in ECW were not, you know, either being paid or they were owed a lot of back pay at that time by Paul Heyman. So while he was the ECW champion, that's true, Awesome approached his cousin, Horace Hogan, who was with WCW at the time. When Horace found out about his money issues with ECW, he went to Hulk. And Hulk helped get Mike Awesome into WCW. Paul Heyman insisted that Awesome did have a contract. Eric Bischoff on his podcast said that was not true. Heyman approached Vince McMahon with the idea of using Taz, who had left ECW already. He had only debuted in WWE a few months earlier. But, you know, by then they had already given up on him. He approached Vince McMahon about using Taz for a match with Mike Awesome to get the title off of him, and then having Taz drop the belt to Tommy Dreamer. Vince McMahon was fine with that, and Heyman worked things out with WCW's legal department for Mike Awesome to work the match and drop the belt, which led to the match here in Indianapolis. Awesome showed up to the building with Doug Dillinger, WCW's head of security. He never came through the locker room out of fear that the ECW roster might do something to him over the way he left the company. There were a lot of people who were very unhappy with him and the way he conducted himself. Instead, he entered through the crowd, which is the same way he left when the match was over. Jeff Jones was Awesome's manager at the time. He issued an open challenge to anyone in the back who wanted to step up and challenge for the ECW championship. Taz answered the call, entered to a gigantic pop to his WWF entrance music. The match lasted a little over a minute. Taz wins with the Taz mission. Awesome gets right back up, just totally no-sells it to go leave. He wanted to get out of there as quickly as possible. He wanted to be anywhere but there. A little over a week later at ECW's Cyber Slam show, Taz dropped the title to Tommy Dreamer, who was then immediately beaten for it by Justin Credible when Francine turned on Dreamer. But not before Vince McMahon booked Taz as the ECW champion to wrestle Triple H as the WWE champion in a champion versus champion match on SmackDown. Tommy Dreamer got involved, accidentally hit Taz with a chair that was intended for Triple H, which cost Taz the match and he was pinned. Now you can look at this one of two ways. It was a way to build heat between Taz and Dreamer ahead of their Cyber Slam match a few days later, or it made Taz look weak and the ECW title look inferior, pinning their champion. And they were in ECW's home market, no less, for that SmackDown taping. They were in Philadelphia. And they had Triple H, the WWF champion, pin Taz, the ECW champion. And Taz did look weak. And Vince McMahon himself, on the Rise and Fall of ECW DVD, when asked why he booked that match in the first place, admitted that he had no idea why they did that. I'll tell you why he did that. He can play dumb all he wants to. I'll tell you right now why he did that. It was quite the sly move on his part. In the span of about a week, he had one of his contracted talents beat a WCW star to win the ECW title, only to then lose on television to the WWE champion. And I'm supposed to believe that he didn't know what he was doing? There was a lot of heat on Awesome from the ECW locker room, and even Joey Styles, you know, when Awesome appeared at the ECW One Night Stand pay-per-view, the first one against Masato Tanaka, he went off on what a Judas he was, and when Awesome hit a suicide dive early in the match out to the floor, Joey Styles on commentary said, oh, it's a shame he didn't actually take his own life, which just makes me cringe thinking about that when you consider that Awesome really did take his own life just 2 years later. I mean, he couldn't have known that, but still, it's like, man, talk about a stiff shot. But the fact is, he was owed a lot of money. I cannot begrudge the guy for doing what he felt he had to do. Now, was there a better way to go about doing it to try to protect ECW a little bit more? Yeah, I guess so. But if the guy isn't being paid, or if he's not being paid what he was promised, you know, then you do what you got to do. Self-preservation, man. You got to look out for yourself sometimes. You got to take care of number one before you take care of number two, three, and four. That's life. That match with Tanaka, by the way, is one of the craziest matches I've ever seen. Best match of that entire One Night Stand pay-per-view, that which I loved. That ECW One Night Stand pay-per-view, the first one, is one of my all-time, probably top three, favorite WWE pay-per-views that they've ever done. 2 days later, on April 15th, 2000, contrary to people thinking that he did not return to the ring until his match with Triple H at SummerSlam in 2002, it was on this date, actually weeks earlier, but it aired locally on this date, on TWA Total Impact, which aired Saturday nights, I believe, Shawn Michaels wrestled his first match since WrestleMania 14, but it did not happen in a WWE ring. During his time away from the company, Michaels started a school, the Texas Wrestling Academy, which turned out students like Brian Danielson, Brian Kendrick, Paul London, Lance Cade. In fact, there was an article about the school around this time in the San Antonio Express News that featured Daniel Bryan bragging about the fact that he had suffered 3 concussions in the span of 3 months. Oof. But Michaels also started a promotion, the Texas Wrestling Alliance. And in the TWA on this date, Michael stepped into the ring for a bunkhouse brawl hardcore match against his old tag team partner, Paul Diamond, going by the name Venom. Nobody outside of that one market in Texas even knew that this match existed until many years later. And even then, it was years before footage of the match finally surfaced online. I mean, now you can find it on YouTube, but it probably wasn't until the last 7 or 8 years that you could even watch this match on the internet. Now, I've seen the match. Michaels hardly took any bumps, but he looked good, and he was moving around fine, and he won with a super kick, regaining control of his company and holding the TWA heavyweight title, which he subsequently vacated. In a WWE.com interview in 2015, he was asked, "Did you ever compete in the TWA?" And he said, "We did. One little thing where I had a hardcore street fight match. I was also the color commentator and the producer of the show, but I did do one match, which was a drawn-out decision when you hear you'll never wrestle again, and if you do, something serious could happen. I wasn't going to wreck myself. If I'm going to do something to take that risk, it's going to be for WWE, but we felt like it was the situation where I wouldn't have to get too physical." And he says it was camouflaged quite well. I would say so, considering that hardly anybody even knew that this happened until many years later. 2 days after that, man, there was a lot of stuff going on that week. But 2 days later, on April 17th, 2000, Raw is War was in State College, Pennsylvania, and Chris Jericho challenged Triple H for the WWE Championship. Jericho just talked about this match during his Broken Skull Sessions interview with Steve Austin. And also on Talk is Jericho last summer, in Jericho's own words, he was this close to quitting the company. Credit to Wrestling Inc. for the transcription here. "The week before, on Sunday Night Heat, they had me lose to Viscera. And at the end of that match, I walked out and was like, you know what? I'm done. I'm going back there next week and I'm going to go talk to Vince. I'm just going to tell him I'm finished, because if this is what they brought me in here to start losing to Big Vis on a jobber show like Sunday Night Heat, then there's no future for me here. So I get into town, it was State College, PA, and I'm walking down the hall. I'm pissed like I've been working myself up all week. And now I'm ready to just let it all out. I'm walking down the hallway and I see one of the writers. His name was Tommy Blacha. He was standing there and he's like, 'Chris, what's going on?' I was like, 'I'm going to go talk to Vince.' And he goes, 'Well, let me tell you what you're doing tonight first.' He goes, 'I don't really care what I'm doing. I've had enough of this place. I'm going to go tell Vince that I want out.' He's like, 'Well, you're going to want to hear what you're doing.' And I'm like, 'I don't care what I'm doing. It doesn't matter.' He goes, 'You're winning the world title.' And I said, 'Wow. You better tell me what I'm doing then.' He's like, 'No, here's what we're going to do. You're going to pick a fight with Hunter. You'll pick a fight with Stephanie. And then you'll do the match and you'll win. And then you'll have to give it back.' And at the time, I was like, 'Whatever you want. This is great.' I remember feeling a little weird about having to just give the title back. So I asked Vince about that. I said, 'Vince, I feel really weird about just giving the belt back. What's the mindset?' He's like, 'It's just the story for tonight. You're going to have it again anyways, so don't worry about it. Just take it and do it and go from there.'" This is one of my favorite segments in Raw history, the Phantom title change. Really, that whole first hour of Raw that night was fantastic television and fantastic storytelling. Mike Chioda was the referee. He gets bumped. Down comes Earl Hebner to replace him. Earl and Triple H, they end up in a shoving match, and down goes Earl. Jericho hits a spinning heel kick, he hits a lion salt, Hebner fast counts him for the three, and only 8 months into the company, Chris Jericho is the WWE champion. Place came unglued. But only through one commercial break. They come back, we see Triple H in the back, dragging Earl Hebner from the locker room back down to the ring. He forces him to reverse the decision, which Earl only agrees to do if Triple H and Stephanie agree to never put their damn hands on him again. "So long as I'm a WWF official, you can't put your damn hands on me again." Those were the key words. "As long as I'm a WWF official." And so Triple H and Stephanie, who they had been abusing their power on TV for a while before this, they go, "Sure, we agree to that." And Earl goes and he retrieves the belt from Jericho. He reverses his decision, straps the belt around Triple H's waist. And then, the asshole heel that he is, Triple H says to Earl, "Oh yeah, I forgot to tell you, you're fired." And now that he's no longer a WWF official, he kicks his ass and he gives him a pedigree. A few segments later, Linda McMahon announced that Stone Cold Steve Austin would be returning from neck surgery for the first time to appear in The Rock's corner for the title match at Backlash. And I have never heard a crowd react this way to an announcement. This was not a match. This was not somebody making their entrance. This was not theme music hitting. This was Linda McMahon, the most bland executive in the entire company, standing in the middle of the ring announcing that Stone Cold Steve Austin is going to come back at the next pay-per-view. And the place, I mean, the people went nuts. Two of the biggest crowd pops in WWE history belong to Linda McMahon, of all people. For this, and when she kicked Vince in the nuts at WrestleMania X7. 14 years ago this week, on the April 16th, 2007 episode of Monday Night Raw, it was the Miracle in Milan, the first ever televised Raw from Italy. Vince McMahon was only a few weeks removed from getting his head shaved at WrestleMania, and he was out there. he was wearing this hat. Oh my God. I mean, we went through like do-rag Vince. We went through a few different stages of Vince post-WrestleMania 23. On this show, he was wearing a hat. It made him look like one of Al Capone's henchmen in some 1920s gangster movie. He said Bobby Lashley wasn't here after the beating he suffered at the hands of Umaga a week earlier, so he threw out an open challenge to anyone in the back who wanted a shot at Umaga's Intercontinental title. No holds barred. And when nobody came out, because apparently the WWE locker room at the time was filled with a bunch of wusses, he looked out into the crowd to find one of the locals, one of the civilians in the audience who wanted to get in the ring, and that is when he found Santino Marella. Santino had spent time in Ohio Valley Wrestling. He wasn't there very long. I think he was only there for a few weeks before he had his little incident with Jim Cornette where he famously got slapped. He got paintbrushed by Cornette after laughing at the boogeyman in an angle in OVW where Cornette was trying to get the boogeyman character over, and he told all the wrestlers to act frightened. And Cornette went off on him in the back and he slapped him around, ended up getting suspended because of it, lost his job not long after that, but there were already issues on both ends between Cornette and WWE, and I guess that was just the final straw for both sides. But during his time down in developmental, Santino had been portraying this Russian shooter type character called Boris Alexeyev. And Paul Heyman had pushed for him to go to the ECW roster. He would have been a protege of Kurt Angle's, who would have eventually turned on him, but he was overruled by the powers that be. They didn't like that idea. But in any event, Mike Bucci, Simon Dean, he was the one who called Marella when he was still in OVW, and he asked him, he goes, "You're Italian, right?" Well, he's not, but he said he was. He had studied some Italian language tapes, like cassette tapes, years earlier, so maybe Bucci knew of that somehow. I don't know why he would have thought the guy was Italian. But on the phone, Santino recites some phrases for him in Italian, and that was enough to convince them that he could speak Italian, even though he was barely conversational in it. He got the phone call on Friday. He flew out to Italy on Saturday. He landed on Sunday, and he debuted on Monday. That's how fast things came together. And when Bobby Lashley did show up and he bashed Umaga in the head with a chair, he placed Santino on top of Umaga, and Santino Marella, in his very first match on Monday Night Raw, won the Intercontinental Championship. And he went on to have a very fruitful career, not as anyone to be taken seriously, but as a total comedy character. There were a ton of comedic moments involving Santino over the years. My personal favorite is the tea time with Santino in the UK when it was him and Vladimir Kozlov and Sheamus, where Sheamus was corpsing at one point on camera because, I mean, how could you not? I don't know how he even managed to keep a straight face. So there's a lot of fun Santino moments over the years. Just don't mention any of them to Jim Cornette. And that is this week in wrestling history. We are going to put off the mailbag this week for tonight because we're going to answer a whole bunch of questions tonight. Again, I've already grabbed some email questions, about a dozen of them, but we're going to take super chat questions. We're putting the show in your hands, live on YouTube tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern. I hope you will join me for a special 700 celebration. Sound off inbox on the YouTube channel. As if we didn't go live enough times last week. What's one more live stream, right? So come join the party tonight. And if you have questions for the mailbag this or any other week, you can always email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. And I want to take this moment here, as I did at the beginning of the show, to thank everybody who has supported this show, whether it was a donation or using one of our sponsor links or subscribing to the YouTube channel or just listening every single week, spreading the word to friends and family, other people who you know are wrestling fans who you think might enjoy the show. I appreciate everybody who has done any or all of those things. Everybody has played their part in making this show a success that has only grown and gotten bigger over the years. You know, later on this year in November, we're going to be celebrating 14 years of the Sound Off. We are in the middle of year 14 right now. And to get to 700 shows, I mean, obviously I've done a lot more than 700, but in terms of the numbered weekly episodes, 700 is a pretty cool number. I mean, I had people email me going, man, is it 700 already? I feel like you were just celebrating 600. It feels that way. It really does. It feels that way. And here we are at 700, and soon it'll be 800 and then 900. And who knows? We may hit 1,000 episodes like Raw did all those years ago. Although I like to think my show is a lot better than Monday Night Raw. Even though it is quite long. It was never my intent for these shows to grow to be this long. But that's largely, I think, because of the history stuff. You guys seem to enjoy the history stuff, so I've enjoyed doing it. We'll keep doing it until September, you know, because when we hit the 1 year mark, unfortunately, it has to go away and we'll have to figure out what else is going to replace it. But I enjoy doing all this stuff. And this show has really, it's become a huge part of my life, not just in the way that I, you know, support myself, but just in terms of making me happy and bringing me a lot of fulfillment and enjoyment. I've got to meet a lot of cool people, and I hope some of those cool people will join me tonight on YouTube. And I say thank you to all of you once again for making this possible. I will be back with episode 701. 701. Because the work never ends. Next Sunday, April 25th. And I will, of course, be live on YouTube Wednesday night for what should be a damn good episode of Dynamite. I got to tell you, I'm really looking forward to that main event. Or if it's not the main event, it should be. Darby Allin defending the TNT title against Jungle Boy. We'll see how much of that 1.2 million audience AEW can retain this week. And all the other news of the week, we'll cover it next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week. I will see you tonight, live, on YouTube. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
That Shane McMahon segment with him and Braun Strowman from Monday night, this will go down among the all-time worst segments that I have ever seen. Absolutely nothing happened. Everything that is wrong with these three-hour shows where they just blather on and they're clearly just stalling for time. If I am fortunate enough to live to a ripe old age in my final days recording Sound Off episode 2798, looking back on my life and how I spent my time, I'm going to remember this Shane McMahon segment and regret the fact that I wasted those minutes of my life that I would give anything to have back. This sucked.
The Solemonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolemonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Solemonster on Twitter @Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solemonster Sounds Off.